Good morning, everyone. This is a pretty amazing group. I was just commenting that quite a while ago, when a couple of us first became commissioners, we used to have a lot of people at our meetings, and they were here for considerably different reasons than today. And then people kind of stopped coming as things settled, and then people are returning because we have things of interest. And so it's really a pleasure to be a PUD commissioner at this point. So welcome to everyone. We're glad you're here today. We have four commissioners present, but four present. And Commissioner Congdon is at home today, ill, but on the phone and participating. So we have a quorum of five. Steve Wright at the head table, and Rebecca Garfine, clerk. And Eric Walquist, our lead attorney. And again, any or all of you are welcome to address the commission. We'll provide an opportunity for you to do that should you choose to. The only thing that I would ask you to do is to use the microphone, state your name, your address, and we will allow a reasonable length of time. And then if you have a cell phone present and on you, please put it in a mode that's not going to disturb the meeting. It only costs you $5 if it rings. Actually, that's a joke, but it's a serious part of what we do. Taking a look at getting our meeting started, we always start with a safety minute, which is our primary goal. At Chelan County PUD, we want everyone to return home at the end of the day with every working part that they came with. And so we want that as a priority and our Pledge of Allegiance. And today to do that is Anna Aguirre. Anna Aguirre. There we go.
I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands. One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
So my name is Anna Aguirre, and I work in the Customer Relations Department. I've been here for almost 4 years, and with the weather getting nicer and spring break coming up, I think about vacations and fun out in the sun, camping, all that good stuff. So my safety tip is going to be on home safety when you're out on a vacation. So before you leave, you know, check your doors, your windows. If you have a sliding door or window, put a metal stick or a wooden stick on there to make sure that nobody tries to pull that open. You can set timers and on your lights outside of your house. If the house is dark, more burglars might think, you know, nobody's around. They might have a better way in. Make sure that your newspapers and mail are picked up or put on hold. If papers and mail are piled up outside of your house, it's obvious that someone hasn't been there. You can leave some blinds or drapes open. It makes it less obvious that you're away. Arrange to have a trusted family member or friend check on your home, even if it's just to water the plants. They can check on things to make sure everything's okay. If you're going on vacation, it's an excellent reminder to ensure you have updated inventory of household goods, of your appliances, your jewelry, firearms, or other valued items. If you do have jewelry or anything valuable in your home, you can put it in a safe deposit box to keep it safe. You can also set timers on electronics inside your house. You can put it on a lamp, on a TV, just to make some noise, make it seem like there's somebody there. Make sure that your home security system is on, and don't forget to tell your friends or family members the code so that they don't set off the alarm while you're gone. If you're going to be gone for a long period of time, arrange for lawn care. And be careful what you post on social media. Sometimes we don't think about it. We want to share everything out there, but everybody does have access to that, and we don't know who's good and who's bad out there sometimes. And the best way you can make sure your home is safe is by having somebody you trust stay in your home to take care of it.
Any questions? Just a comment. We have a middle son who's a police officer. One of the things he suggests, whether you have a dog or not, go out and buy the biggest water bowl that you can find, put water in it, and put it by your back door. If you have a fenced backyard where people, you know, can't see, people who intrude oftentimes will look to see if there's a large pet, perhaps. So the bigger the bowl, the bigger the threat. And it's cheap. It's cheap. Thank you. Appreciate it. Let's take a look at the agenda. Any additions, corrections, changes in the agenda?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we take resolution number 9 to the consent agenda.
Okay.
Concur.
Okay. It's been suggested to bring resolution 9 to the consent agenda, and it's there was concurrence. Any objections? Okay, resolution 9 will then be part of the consent agenda. Any other thoughts? All right. General Manager Steve Wright, item 3, CPO winner.
I want to invite our cycle of personal ownership awardees to come up if they could. So once a month, we do identify folks who have done a tremendous job of stepping forward and displaying the type of personal accountability that we want to encourage in the organization. This is really a goal for us around focusing on people who step forward and say, hey, here's an opportunity that we could be doing something better, and own it and actually go off and make it happen. So really proud of the fiber team for the work that they have done. They were asked to think about putting together a program for careers after school, and they could have just mailed it in. They didn't. They really put a lot of time and effort into this. And all the feedback that we have was that the participants loved the project that they were able to be engaged in and the opportunity to engage with some of our employees. So I'd love it if we could just take a moment if they'd introduce themselves. And then we always give them the opportunity to say something if they would like to. They're not forced to, but something about their project if they would like to do that.
Yeah, we're recorded, so not that that helps, but we're recorded, so that's the only way that listening public will know who's speaking and why.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm Dustin Bristow, communications foreman, fiber specialist. We thought it was neat to give the kids an opportunity to learn something very different. When I was 19, right out of high school, I was very fortunate to have an opportunity to start working for a repair depot for data communications. That job led into a job working in two-way radios for 8 years. That job led to another job. That one led to this one. And I'm here to stay. And because I was given an opportunity, a very, very good one, I'm always looking for opportunities to give back to kids, you know, wondering how they're going to make it in the world and you know, show them something maybe different, something different that they might be interested in. So.
My name is Corey Countryman, communication lineman. Do a lot of construction and mostly splicing. I just thought it was really cool for the kids. I thought they had a lot of fun learning to splice, at least at my station, seeing all what those guys do. And I think some of the kids who weren't sure at first, once they got in there and got their hands on stuff and got to actually see how the splicing works and all that, I thought they thought it was pretty cool. So it was pretty cool to be a part of.
My name is Chad Payne. I'm a fiber specialist, been with the district for almost 17 years. So having the opportunity to participate with these kids was pretty golden for me. Seemed like the kids were really engaged. They were very interested. They came up with some pretty good questions. Luckily, we had Eleanor in case the questions got too technical. And if she couldn't handle it, Bob was over there, who's over there, was with us as well. So he was a good backup. One of the funniest questions was, one kid said, will an internet blocker work on the fiber, and we're like, oh no, maybe you should direct your energies down a different avenue. So yeah, that was one thing I would like to say is starting to get a little nervous here. Anyway, I would like to say thank you to the commissioners and the senior management for letting us take the time and resources to do programs like this, you know, invest back into the community. I mean, you have the big ticket projects like the Wildlife Reserve, Sage Hills, or the parks, you know, they get all the limelight, all the glory. But the smaller things like the STEM program, Helping Hand, and gosh, the River of Power, all those, they all take energy and time and resources. So it's really cool, and I take a lot of pride in the fact that my employer, the Schlamm PUD, invest so much back into the community, and a lot of it people don't even realize.
Good job, Chad.
Britt Simmons, communication foreman, Spicer. Yeah, what we did that night was pretty cool. What it gave the kids a chance to see was basically got Dustin and Chad to do a lot of the inside stuff in our nodes, CTC, that type of work. Corey and I do a lot of the splicing outside, so we had a splice trailer. Kind of show them. We also had a tent. Sometimes you can't get a trailer to some areas, so we set up a tent. So kind of gave them a real world what it's supposed to be like. So overall, I think it was great. Kids had a good time. We had a good time. So thank you.
I'm Eleanor Hanstock. I'm a telecom engineer. These guys did all the hard work, so I feel like I'm just tagging along because I was just there for the engineering support. And also make sure if there are any girls in the audience, they will feel totally comfortable being there. So it was what they did was very well received. The kids, they showed great interest. They asked very good questions. Like this, for example, one simple question: what is dark fiber? Should be obvious, but I say, hey, that's a cool question to ask. Mm-hmm. They also asked other good questions like, do you have mentorship programs? What education is needed to do the work you need to do? So that it is really my honor to be able to represent the department and the PUD. And be able to just help those young people in their pursuit of their careers that we individuals and the organization are so willing to invest in the young people's lives to get them a good start. So that's really great. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'd like to just comment that several times the gentleman in front of us and sorry, Eleanor, but I just haven't seen you out in the field with, you know, with these guys working as not only people who install and take care of the fiber, but interact with our customers. And you guys are great ambassadors, as I'm sure, Eleanor, you are. But it's great to watch you do your work, the care and concern that you express, the opportunity to, you know, work with our public. And I can also tell you that they are always glad to see you show up because you're bringing them something that is highly desirable and that they want. And if it wasn't for the engineering support, your work would be different as well. So thanks to all of you. Thanks for representing us really well in the public and in the work you do. And it's much appreciated. I just thought it was interesting a couple of years ago with the Chelan fires that people began to ask for their fiber to be reinstalled prior to having their electricity reinstalled. And so it shows, I think, from our public how important they take what you do. So thanks for doing it, and thanks for doing it well, and much appreciation.
Dennis, can I make a
Absolutely.
Comment? Dustin, I just wanted to thank you for your comment about opening up doors. And for boys, girls, adults, Gene Sherrod is here in the audience, and he was one of the people that opened up a door for me. And what we do is give kids, adults, future employees, community members, people in our county, opportunities, and whether they take that opportunity, actually walk through the door, I think it's really important to, you just never know who's going to walk through a door that's been provided to them and improve their lives or make go off in a different direction. And doors for me, not only as a college student, as a teacher, but also in my adult career. You know, just you just never know when those doors are provided to people, who's going to walk through them and the choices that they make, and that the education and the self-improvement they're going to continue to make even into their adult career. I never figured out what I was going to do in my life. So that it keeps unfolding. And, you know, for those of us who never really knew what we were going to do, we just kind of stumble along, and it's really important. And, you know, we're going to be talking about hydro research and, again, some more doors opening up for our employees and our adults and girls and boys. And it's just, I really, really appreciate your work, taking the time to spend some time with those students. You just don't know how important that is. So thank you very much.
Yeah. One thing that you did that I'm still having to explain to the public in my neighborhood is when we first moved into a townhouse setting, neighbors immediately said, "Oh, you're a commissioner. So when are we going to get our fiber?" And I said, "Well, that's a great question. I don't know, but I know who I can call. I can call Mike Coleman and find out." But you have to understand, as a commissioner, we have no ability to influence that decision whatsoever. That's made a year in advance. And so, but let me call and I'll get an answer for you. So I called Mike and asked him, and he said, "I'll call you back in a little bit." And he called back in a little bit, and he said, "That's tomorrow." So I can deny any influence on that all I want, but you guys showed up the next day and started stringing fiber, and people still think that I have magic here. And little do they know, I have zero. But anyway, you did great work, and my neighbors are still in love with you and me, but they're like, "God, how did that?" You know, you just ask the commissioner, and it happened. Like, "Yeah, it doesn't work that way." But anyway, but thank you for doing a great job, and appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
Get back to work.
Coffee breaks over. Huh?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, that was so funny. Yeah. Showed up and
get to be a hero.
Yeah. So, item number four, Hydro Research Institute.
So we've moved our agenda around a little bit to put the Hydro Research Institute discussion up front because we have some visitors who are interested in this as well. Kirk Hudson's going to present. I just want to be clear, we're not seeking a decision today. I want to give you an update, but we continue to make, and really Kirk has just done a tremendous job here, really make some great progress here. I should say Kirk and John Yale really have made some great progress. So give you an update on where things are at. We will be addressing what we want to do with public power benefit funding for next year, later than the next, probably about a month or so. But this is a way to get a sense of what's happening with this program. So Kirk and John, turn it over to you.
Good morning. Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. With me, I've got John Yale, Hydro Engineering Manager. And we should start every board meeting that way with that. And that was great with the fiber group. As Steve said, this is information only. We will come back. We plan to come back on April 16th, which will give you the full purview of public power benefit projects and funding. So you can see how this fits into it. You'll hear a recommendation today and then see how this fits in with other public power benefit projects on the table. I will just kind of cut to the chase and just let you know that our recommendation is to form the Hydropower Research Institute, and we'll be talking through that as we go. Wanted to make sure that was really clear. So we're going to provide a status of the current projects that have been approved to date, the conclusions we've reached thus far, and then the recommended path forward. And it might be a good time just to introduce some guests here, and so they don't need to come up, but just for the sake of people that are listening in and those in the room, I'll just start in the back. Just there's a bullet point here on one of the slides that talks about collaboration within the community across different sectors of the community. So some of them are here today that have been working on a research and innovation district in Greater Chelan, Douglas, North Central Washington area, and that's why they're interested. But Jim Richardson and Stacy, from president of Wenatchee Valley College, Stacy Lickensmeyer from Wenatchee Valley College. We got Amanda Lundy from 2020 Logic, Gene Sherritt, who leads a number of statewide education initiatives and well-known in the Valley from the education standpoint, is here. And Sue Kane from the STEM Network. We've got Steve King and Allison Williams from the City of Wenatchee. I think I hit everybody. And then just internally, there's a number of people working on this internally. We've got Teresa Boucher, heavy involvement. We've got Ingrid Miller from Finance and Risk Management. And I saw Katie Yunt somewhere from Legal. I think I hit everybody for the most part that's doing a lot of the heavy lifting. And Suzanne Grizel from External Affairs. So a lot of people have been working on this to get to this point. And John Yang on the engineering side. So summary of the funding already approved. Got three projects that the board has approved for this hydro research effort. First one is our data analytics platform. There's $200,000 approved from the 2015-2016 public power benefit. And we've spent all of that. And that was our work underway in designing a data analytics platform. The second project, sensor technology development, you might recall from the previous presentation, we had a certain sensor we were interested in developing. So we had $50,000 from the 2015-2016 public power benefit and $150,000 from 2018 dedicated to that. We haven't spent anything there yet, and I'll explain why as we get further. And then the third project, John's been working really hard on, Rocky Reach turbine generator model, a computer model. We had $250,000 in 2017 dedicated to that and another $100,000 for this year. Spent a good chunk of the $250,000 last year, and I think John's planning to spend every penny on the dollars allocated for this year, doing some great work there. So in summary, there was $750,000 that were allocated to this effort, and we've spent about $400,000 and do expect to spend at least $500,000 with the dollars that are already allocated. Our conclusions thus far is that the main thing we're finding is the concept of aggregating hydro operational data is very valuable. We haven't found where that exists in the industry. The more we talk to others, the more we find that others are very interested in this concept and willing to contribute dollars towards it as well. The interest thus far, we found, we've talked to our peer hydro owners. There's a lot of interest in the industry of collecting and aggregating data. The one thing that all hydro owners are collecting data, and some are in various stages of their capabilities of analyzing the data. The one thing that everybody is challenged with is they're limited to their data and only their data. So what this concept offers is the ability to compare the data across multiple hydro owners, very valuable concept. Manufacturers are very interested from the standpoint of they design and install equipment that hydro owners use. They have a hard time assessing the risks that they're exposed to once they turn that equipment over to a hydro owner. They don't have the ability to see how that equipment is operating day in and day out. So there's another valuable connection there in terms of the value of the data set, the operational data, not just for the one company that they sold the product to, but multiple companies that they sell their products to. I'm going to let John talk a little bit about the national labs and college and university connection. He's doing a lot of work in this regard as well.
So we've had a lot of conversations with Department of Energy, Oak Ridge National Labs, PNNL, and they're all very interested in the data. one of the challenges they have is actually getting data analyzed. They can get individual company data, perhaps some performance data, benchmarking data from different areas. But one challenge they have is getting a big data set. They recognize in the industry, you know, we have 31 units. That's only 31 units worth of data. And so their interest is in this aggregation, being able to see all the way across the North American hydro fleet. So they've got great interest there. They would like to do some work on basically three legs of it, the cost and performance data, so the benchmarking type data, the unit performance data, and then the maintenance side of things. How is the operations affecting the maintenance? So they're viewing that data set. At the college and university level, we're working in a couple areas. One is with teams at WSU and Seattle University actually looking at some sensor technology for us as part of their capstone projects for their seniors in electrical and mechanical engineering. And also working on a relationship with Wenatchee Valley College with the new technology program there, the four-year engineering technology, trying to put together where we would actually have a student from the university working with us in this area year-round from that program.
As mentioned earlier, there is interest regionally in research collaboration across not just the hydropower, but agriculture, healthcare, and technology as well. Just to explain the concept a little bit further, the diagram on the screen. Again, the real value and the real offering that the Hydropower Research Institute would have is the aggregated data set. With that would come the ability to have some base level of dashboards and analytics capability built in. But there's two different groups. There's a member group. These would be the people that hydro owners that are actually providing data to be aggregated. And then there's a subscriber group, which is the interest we just covered. There would be others that aren't necessarily providing data, but they would have an interest in the data to use for what they do provide. I'll let John speak to all the potential applications we've uncovered here.
So other than our dreams, there are some real uses here. One is for us and others in the industry to be able to make better business decisions. We can look towards reducing forced outage by better predicting how something might behave. Then we can plan for failures rather than experiencing those. We can do benchmarking among various utilities, which is basically looking to see, hey, these folks are performing better and why. And so can we perform that way by doing what they're doing? Improve our O&M practices. Maintenance over history has gone from a time-based, reactive, and moving towards a predictive type maintenance. It's more efficient to do that. It takes data and information to predict things. Improving our predictive capabilities for both of that. Doing just good old-fashioned research for the good of building the blocks. You know, the basic work is what that advances to the specific work that we can do. We need to look at new sensors and monitoring equipment. We're collecting data now, but there's a lot of things that the modeling has shown we're not getting data on, and there are sensors out there we might be able to deploy. There's also things we don't even know what kind of sensor we could do, but we do know we need to look in that area. And lastly, we could use this then with the relationships with the manufacturers to improve what we're seeing in the way of quality and terms. If we have better predictive information, then perhaps we can structure warranties, contract terms, even technical requirements that'll support better equipment over its life.
That's just the beginning. There really are a lot of other things we could do with this. So that's what we're finding, strictly focused on the operational equipment side of things. But like I said, there are a lot of opportunities. I know Commissioner Bowles mentioned the connection with the environmental data in one of the last presentations we did. That's just a whole nother avenue that this can go. So the recommendations for the next steps are, one, to incorporate the Institute as a nonprofit corporation in Chelan County. The second piece in order to do that would be to develop the articles of incorporation, bylaws, and operational plan, and select a contract operator. Timing, we're thinking, is possible. If we get the green light in April, that we could do that between now and August. For the funding aspect of this, we're looking for $500,000. We think the $200,000 that we have already allocated for the sensor technology that we haven't spent yet would be better repurposed at this point, dedicated towards the formation of the institute. We think that that will be leveraged further once the institute is formed and further technology development can happen that way, where there's more hydro owners participating and more interest. Developing new technology can come with risk, and so the more we can get others involved, the less risk for everybody in terms of developing new technology. That's why we're making that recommendation to move that $200,000 for the formation of the institute. And then an additional $300,000 for the 2019 public power benefit dollars, or the unallocated 2018 dollars. So there's approximately $1.2 million that's unallocated from 2018. So 300 of that could be used for this effort or future public power benefit funding. Solicit additional hydropower owner membership and subscribers once we have the formation, and then begin aggregating data with, we already have commitments from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Southern Company in the Southeast, two very important potential partners here that have committed their data. We have three plants and 31 units. The Corps of Engineers has 75 plants and 356 generating units. So if we want to get a big aggregated data set, there's no better place to start than with the Corps of Engineers. And Southern Company has 32 plants with 102 units. So there's a pretty big data set to start right off the bat. With that, I'd open it up to any questions.
Commissioners, Randy?
Well, I'm not sure if it'll fall in the question line, but the comment line, this is exciting. I mean, it's truly exciting. And I'm reminded of a lot of comments that are made about industries as they develop and evolve over time, how the needs change. And we have, in the United States, most of our hydro capability is in aging plants that are needing rehabilitation, and we're at that really special moment in time. And you know, I've seen it in other industries, agriculture being one, that that ability to share data and information about best practices in terms of hydro operations can, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats. Potential is very, very real, and I think we could be doing a huge, huge benefit to the entire hydro industry, not only here in North America, but potentially worldwide with information like this. And so it excites me. Just, I was going to ask you or Steve about the curiosity question that came up, recognizing that we have close to half the hydro operation in the Northwest of all the United States. So what a perfect place for an institute like this. But does the Corps operate all the dams, or does Bureau of Reclamation operate any?
In the federal system, the Corps of Engineers and Bureau of Reclamation both have projects. For example, Grand Coulee is a Bureau of Reclamation project. But in the Northwest, Corps has most of the dams, but Grand Coulee is so big, they're about evenly split between the megawatts of capacity.
Oh, gee. Yeah. But this is exciting.
Other thoughts, comments? You know, I can't let it pass. Kirk and John, the team that you've assembled when you were introducing the various members, I'm just sitting here listening. It's going like, my God, what a brain trust, you know, of internal people working on this. And I've talked with several, and the individual enthusiasm about this project and the professionalism and the stimulation of professional interest is about as high as you can get. This is a great project. So are we looking at any we're going to be working across organizations, a common platform of data collection, for analytics to be performed so that the data that's fed in does not have to be interpreted, but it can be on a common platform?
Yeah, so what we're thinking on analytics is we will provide a base level of analytics using open source software. Now, that being said, there are some hydro owners that have gone gangbusters on their own analytics capabilities, and they're purchasing proprietary software.
Oops. I think that's an indication I've exceeded my number of questions.
Yeah. So back to the analytics capabilities. So we would set this up so that it wouldn't preclude anybody that's already using somebody in proprietary software. They'd be able to use that with this data set so that we're providing a real flexible way for people to analyze the data, either Perfect. Use the base level analytics provided or use what you have.
Yeah. Thank you. Comment?
I just wanted to perhaps build on what Commissioner Bolts and Commissioner Smith have already said. I was reading some articles over the weekend, and interestingly enough, it was referring to the hydro industry as being your grandfather's industry. Not much changes. With the introduction of the Hydro Research Institute, I see that really being a game changer for the entire industry. My background being in securities and watching companies that have come and gone, companies that have been around for a long time and stumbled or allowed time to erode who they were, their identity, and their dominance in an industry. That's always a concern of mine as a commissioner, but I think the Hydro Research Institute addresses a lot of those concerns. It creates a new path forward for an industry that has been here a long time, and you haven't seen a lot of dynamic changes in the past, but that's about to change. And so I'm very excited to see the concept and to see the potential for the future. And I want to kind of jump on what Commissioner Bolt said. You know, we truly do have a brain trust that is behind this project, and that makes it even more exciting because I think there's two reasons. One is we certainly have the brain power to move this forward in our staff, and also with the educational institutions that have been named. But secondarily, I think it's going to be kind of fun for some folks that, look at coming to work every day as being the same as it was yesterday, but now all of a sudden it's going to be different, and the future is going to look really exciting. So I'm glad that we're going to be able to provide somewhat of a challenge and an opportunity at the same time for the staff. So that's great. Good job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Public comment. I'm sorry.
No, I know we have quite a few part of your subscriber partners. I didn't know if anybody else wanted to speak on behalf of the project.
Come on up.
Come on up and grab the microphone, please.
Good morning, Steve King, City of Wenatchee. And maybe on behalf of the Research and Innovation District and the Our Valley, Our Future effort, I just want to say thank you to these guys. Thank you for your guys' support. This is amazing. And I just am over here with a grin ear to ear as you guys talk about this. If I was in WSU in the Albrecht Hydraulics Lab today at age 20, I'd be all over this stuff. And when I was there 20 years ago, it was collecting dust. So good job. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for pointing that out to me. I appreciate that. Great to be here this morning. I just want to come in support of the Innovation Institute and the district you're doing with the hydropower. I think it's fantastic, and we've had a good relationship over the last 4 or 5 months. And the issues that really are key to me is that this is an opportunity for our entire region to come together on research topics that are of common interest, predictive analytics, sensor technology, fiber, the kinds of things that we're all doing in ag, in medical, and in hydro. We haven't ever shared those best practices before, And what we're doing now through your leadership, thank you very much, Steve, and the commissioner's leadership, is coming together to share really best practices. Within a mile of where we live right now, there is research going on in ag and in hydro and all kinds of things right now, but we don't get together to share those best practices. We can all learn and gain from those, so I really appreciate that. Predictive analytics, big data sets, it's really what's going on in Washington right now. How do we get data sharing agreements? Who has the data? How can we use it? How can we move it forward? I currently chair Governor Inslee's STEM Education Innovation Alliance, which is over 100 companies in the state of Washington from Facebook and Microsoft and Boeing and others. And this is exactly the topics we're working on all the time across the state, and the Department of Commerce and others are really engaged in this work too. So we really applaud you guys for this work, and we stand behind you and ready to help you in any way that we possibly can. So thank you for the great work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gene.
Please, Jim.
First of all, Wenatchee Valley College is very much behind this. You mentioned our degree in engineering technology. We're also looking, because of this industry, but also because of the healthcare industry and the agriculture industry, we're looking at data analytics as a bachelor's degree, which would fit, obviously, right in with the people that hopefully you're hiring in this institute. And we are very much supporting looking at a place to put this also. It could be housed at the college if it wasn't housed here. So that's another thing we've talked a little bit about, looking at our support for this, and we're very supportive.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Quickest way to get rid of one commissioner, I've told John Yale, when he retires, I'm going too. Please don't go for a while, okay?
As long as we keep doing this, you're stuck for a while.
Perfect. Any other comments, questions? Thank you very much. This is truly exciting. Yeah. Appreciate
thank
it.
You. Thank you. Thank you.
Item 5, update on load requests of less than 5 megawatts.
So I want to talk about high-density load update. And while the focus here is below 5 megawatts, it really started with the conversation regarding the above 5 megawatt request that we got. So recall that about a year ago, after nearly 2 years of study, we put in place the high-density load rate that applied to below 5 megawatts, and then we sat back and said, well, what will happen with that? And it generally was a fairly measured response up until about November, December, when the prices for Bitcoin went skyrocketing up. And as a result of that, we began to get these large load requests, and that forced us to really think through a number of things, including how would we price for above 5 megawatts, and what's the relationship for above 5 megawatts to below 5 megawatts. And we discovered that there were some challenges in terms of pricing, and we also discovered that if we have differences in how we would price above 5 megawatts versus below 5 megawatts, all we're doing is encouraging people to split their loads and to take the 100 megawatt requests and turn it into 25 megawatt requests. So the consistency across those became very important. The other thing I would say is we've talked about before how we are overwhelmed from a workload standpoint in terms of addressing.
Teak is apparently not overwhelmed.
It's pretty good timing, though.
Apparently my phone wanted to help you with
So we have been overwhelmed with the work that's come in, and it's impacting our ability to accomplish the rest of the district performance plan. So we're also going to talk a little bit today about how we're seeing that work and what are some of the things that we might want to consider relative to trying to manage that work so we're able to address the service requests that are coming in, but also go forward on all the other things that are important to the county in terms of the district performance plan that we had laid out for you earlier this year. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to this team to describe to you where we stand today, and there will be a request for board action at the end of this presentation.
Good morning, Commissioners. Lindsay Mons, Business Manager in Customer Utilities, and with me today I have Lyle Moore, our Customer service engineering supervisor, and Chad Bowman from transmission. So today's discussion, we're going to talk a little bit about, or quite a bit about, loads 5 megawatts and less, and those unauthorized loads and challenges that we see with those smaller loads. We'll also talk.
Yeah, it's probably Commissioner Condon.
Let's hope.
We'll go ahead and continue now, and then we'll pick her up if she calls back. Thank you.
So as we talk through these things, we'll also touch on some of the areas that we're looking at for review, things like regulations, fees and charges, and our rate schedules. We'll talk about just a bit more on challenges over 5 megawatts. Steve has covered these at length at some of our previous presentations recently, and we'll talk about next steps. As noted on this slide, and Steve mentioned, we do have action requested today. And since I think when everyone gets a presentation, they quickly flip to the back to read the conclusion, I think it's no surprise to hear that we are requesting a moratorium today. So have that in mind as we're talking through this presentation and understanding the risks that we face. So I'll turn it over to Lyle.
Good morning, Commissioners. This slide here represents what we have in operation right now is approved loads. These loads have gone through our application process, a little representation where we see them throughout the county there. A couple notes, we have 22 approved and active HDL loads right now with a combined total approved load of 13.5 megawatts. Approximately 9 megawatts, a little bit more than that, is up and running right now, and we anticipate the remainder coming online real soon. And this slide here represents the number of applications that we have pending right now. We have approximately 19 of them with a pending load of 16 megawatts spread out through the county. And this is a real dynamic number. These numbers are changing all the time, but this is what we're looking at today. Some of the challenges that we're facing in that the number of applications coming in right now are almost to the point of 2017 numbers. So we've seen a marked increase through January, February of this year here. The challenges with this high volume, it really impacts our ability to provide quality customer service. It's impacting our traditional organic load growth applications that we're seeing. Just a note of example is generally in the winter, we're working on O&M and capital type work, in the engineering department. And we have not spent a lot of time on that this year. We're processing these applications. A few more challenges identified here usually involve a few more engineers involved in the applications. We're getting system engineers involved. We're getting material specialists involved. Something to point out on this is with the number of applications that we're seeing, we are starting to feel the infrastructure limitations that we have, and we are not able to meet the requirements that of the requested loads. It's going to require significant improvements to capital infrastructure. With that, in addition to these applications that we're receiving, we're starting to feel the challenge of people not following our policies and following the application processes, and they're starting to mine, perform Bitcoin mining, cryptocurrency type mining in unapproved locations, and that's what our next slides are going to talk about. This slide here represents a graph of where we're seeing them in our county. It gives you some numbers that we have found 28 customers that are involved in cryptocurrency that were not approved loads. They did not follow our process of application, or they started to follow the process and went silent, dormant on us, and started doing it before they were approved. Out of this, 19 of them have stopped. We've worked with them and got them to stop. Part of those stopped because they did not want to follow the process or pay the costs associated with these types of requests. 9 of them did follow our process and go through and paid the appropriate fees and are up and running. Something to note on here, we do have a watch list where we have about 12 that we are watching right now, monitoring them each month, checking their loads. Here's a couple examples.
Lyle, may I ask a question, please?
Yes.
Of the ones who were on the list, have come off the list, those who have reestablished themselves, followed the procedures, about what is the megawatt use of those people who have become compliant? Do we know?
Those numbers are small loads, about half a megawatt.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Here's a couple examples. We've got a video here on the left of a residential meter. This is a typical home that we have in our county here at 7 o'clock in the morning on a cold winter morning. You can see the dish turning there. That's pretty typical of what we see. The next meter here is 7 o'clock in the morning. Within a couple days, this is an unapproved mining operation. You can see the difference in how fast that meter is turning.
Lyle, I'm going to ask you to hold up for 1 second. Commissioner Condon is back in cell phone range, so we're just going to hook her back up here.
Hello.
Hi, Ann. This is we're back.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
This slide here, investigation findings. When we come across a service that we think is mining, we start investigating what that looks like with some load profile metering, start contacting the customers and asking them some questions. Some of the findings that we come up with is we typically find that the service equipment is overloaded because it wasn't sized appropriately to meet these kind of loads. We also find that a lot of these loads are in spaces that were not designed to handle this kind of load. Maybe it's a lease space, maybe it's an older building that they went into. Working with regulatory agencies like Illinois, we find a lot of loads that the building was approved for electrical service, but it was not approved for this type of load. And that's a real safety concern. Emerging trends that we feel with all of our outreach, we are finding co-location advertising on social media where there are ads out there saying that come to Chelan County. We're here and up and running. We're also working with realtors. We deal with them and hear from them constantly that they are receiving constant calls from people trying to locate into our area here. And basically, we're discovering unauthorized use just about every week. It's a constant strain on resources, monitoring and looking for these people and then putting in place what it takes to get them aligned and matched up with policy.
So we do have several tools in place to address the unauthorized HDL usage, the most effective, of course, being disconnection of service. They're pretty quick to act when we send out servicemen to disconnect a meter. However, because of, you know, what Lyle has talked about, the staff time and effort that's associated with these, there's a significant amount of cost that goes along with any of these tools that we have, be it the investigation portion, the ongoing monitoring, or any of that associated with unauthorized loads. So when we look at proposed tools, we are thinking about things like fees and charges for that investigation and monitoring effort. We're also looking at fees and charges for equipment degradation. So the equipment that's in the field is actively losing life. You know, it's a natural part of aging infrastructure or that, but it's accelerated with the high usage of the cryptocurrency mining. So we're looking at ways to recoup those costs. We're also looking at ways to clarify or processes for reporting the theft of the utility service when they're purposely operating in ways that they're not authorized to. And we're also looking at our processes for working with the local municipalities and government agencies on the public safety and their various actions that the local governments have taken. So those are some of the upcoming items on unauthorized HDL usage.
So, Lindsay, these that are not compliant are probably paying a residential rate.
Pardon? I didn't catch
that.
Depends on their location, Commissioner.
Okay. So some of them could be then not, they would be paying a residential rate. So when we discover these people, are we going back and after them for the rate that they have avoided that should have been on a different scale?
We are looking at that more actively now. Okay. We've had that ability and just recently did some research to ensure that we could go back and charge those. So.
Okay.
All right. So for all high-density loads, we have had a rate schedule in place for a little over a year now. It went into effect in January of 2017. So we've been collecting data this whole time. We have meters on those facilities that collect 15-minute increment data. So we're really able to see the impact on or the profiles of these loads. And as a result, we need to take a look at the rate assumptions that we made when we put the rate into place. Back in 2016. So things like the characteristics of the load, you know, how different are they from what we thought, and how does that impact cost? Looking at the definition of the class, making sure that we're picking up everyone we should pick up, and we're not picking up those that we shouldn't pick up. We're looking at our basic charge tiers. The assumption on the tiers when we went in was that the smaller size would have a lower cost to administer, and the higher, larger size loads would have a higher cost to administer, but we're actually seeing the inverse of that, where the smaller size loads require a lot more time and effort to manage versus the larger loads, which typically just come on and operate. So we're looking at that. We're looking at other risks that may be associated with costs that we haven't captured in the rate analysis already. And we're also looking at overall district costs and how that might impact this class and whether a kind of a standard escalator in that rate would be appropriate. Also part of Rate 35 is our upfront capital charge. It's referenced in the rate schedule. It's housed in fees and charges. And we're looking at this as well, looking at the cost recovery timelines. We made some assumptions going in that a portion of the capital could be recovered over time with these customers and just their business model and their propensity to move around. We're seeing that might not have been the best assumption. We're reviewing our approach on the distribution side. On the replacement cost there, we're looking at cost recovery risk when we're having to derate equipment. So one thing we hadn't anticipated or fully understood going in was that, you know, in some cases we're having to derate equipment 30 to 50%. So if it's a 5-megawatt load request, we may be having to install infrastructure for 7.5 megawatts. So that's an increase or a different cost. And probably the most significant item is that we need to add an infrastructure cost component for transmission. When we were doing this effort before, we were only seeing a handful of smaller loads. As we see more load requests and larger load requests, it is having an impact on transmission that we had not planned for. So Chad Bowman's going to talk through an example of some of the things that we're looking at on transmission.
Chad, let me just take 1 second and explain that when we went with the HDL rate, we were focused on a variety of costs, including the issue associated with capital related to distribution system costs. Because they were under 5-megawatt loads, conclusion that I drew at least was, let's get this out there and try it and find out how many of these loads we actually get before we get into the transmission issue, because transmission will be very difficult to deal with. Conceptually, it's just more challenging in terms of understanding the different costs in various parts of our system. So we've done that. We've tried that for a while. I think now, as we're looking at a whole bunch of above 5-megawatt loads, it becomes absolutely clear that you would need to address transmission. If you get 100-megawatt requests on our system, there's going to be a transmission cost associated with that. So we need to address that. And again, what we have discovered is that if we are addressing transmission costs in the above 5-megawatt load and we don't have it in the below 5-megawatt load, then we're just encouraging people to split the loads and get below 5 megawatts. So it means we're going to have to deal with it on both above and below 5 megawatts. So with that, Chad has done some really great work to help us better understand this, put us in a position to be able to discuss it.
Thank you for that. Right, really when we look at HDL loads and knowing that rate applies across the county, and you've heard really from Lyle about how those loads are kind of dispersed across the county. There's unauthorized loads in various places. Really from the transmission perspective and trying to understand, well, how do you study that? How do you look at that? How do you really come up with a transmission cost for that? What we've done and Steve suggested and seems like a really good way to go is to use a 100 megawatt load as a proxy really in the more challenging areas of our system, which are really at the borders or the edges of our system, which are furthest away from generation. So, and then look at what does that 100 megawatt load do to the system and what types of improvements might you have to make there. So a group of us, really the guys that study the system every day, sat down and went through this using, at this point in time, as an example, you know, their engineering judgment, rule of thumb estimates that we use for a lot of projects. And really, like I say, when you look at those edges of the system and put that 100 megawatt load as a proxy for what HDL loads might do, where you end up with a tipping point that causes a large transmission investment, you really see those marginal costs at the bottom of the slide. Manson Wapato could be $450 to $500 a kW, up towards Leavenworth, $400 to $450 a kW. And when we looked at this, we looked at most of the county, but not all. We think there's parts of the county where it's probably impractical to connect an HDL load, and that the capacity of the system there is really to serve native load, and the issues there are very challenging, such that it would be difficult to connect a load. So that area is really the one the example we have right now, and maybe we find more as we work through this, is between Leavenworth and Stevens Pass along an old line that was constructed in the 30s. That line is still there, mostly in existing form, serves a bunch of those rural communities. There's not much capacity left in it. It's about 100 miles long between Leavenworth and Beverly over in near Everett. So the cost there would seem to be very significant to do something there. And that's really kind of a depiction of what that area might look like.
I want to make sure that these costs are put in context. So in the current HDL rate, we charge $190 a kilowatt for the distribution system cost. So that's an upfront charge. For a megawatt, you just add three zeros. So it's $190,000 a megawatt. If we're adding a transmission charge, at least what we're contemplating at this point is something in that $450 to $500 a kilowatt range. So it's a substantial increase in the upfront cost. It reflects what we believe to be the real costs on our system, though, in fact, if we're adding these loads in any kind of substantial amount, we will need to add transmission. And the risk that we have, again, with the difference in business models, is that we would incur a substantial cost in the range of, say, for 100 megawatts, $45 to $50 million with a risk of cost recovery associated with that. And that's why we went to the upfront charge for distribution component. And that's why we would consider going to an upfront charge for the transmission component as well.
Wow.
All right. So far we've talked mainly about loads less than 5 megawatts. And Steve covered loads over 5 megawatts substantially in the last few meetings. But just a couple items here on loads over 5 megawatts as they relate to cryptocurrency. We do see some very specific things or risks or challenges associated with that. And one of them is responding to the large requests in a very short period of time. A lot of times they want to be up and running in 3 to 6 months. And we just don't have that capacity on our system. It's going to require construction of substations and things like that. And in doing that, we delay other projects. So you saw at the last meeting impacts on the balance scorecard. One of them was deferral of the Chelan substation and the Leavenworth substation. And that has the potential to impact thousands of customers, long-term customers in the future, putting that on hold in order to connect one that we don't know how long we'll be here. So that's one challenge that we face in engineering and in operations particularly. And quite often we see these loads shifting between above 5 megawatts and below 5 megawatts. So if they think they can get connected faster at one level or another, they'll switch fairly rapidly between the two. So we're juggling those applications there. They're also seeking as much capacity as they're able to get. So they'll put in an application. If we say they can't, we don't have that capacity, their first question will be, well, how much can I get? So that takes a lot more analysis and limits our ability to serve our normal load or our organic load. And then just the business model mismatch between the district and these customers creates a handful of unique risks that we really want to analyze before, you know, as we work through rates. We don't want to be in a rush. We want to foresee some of these challenges and make sure that we get it right going into some of these larger load contracts. So with that said, next steps, the first bullet here is that staff does recommend a moratorium on the computing and data processing loads related to the cryptocurrency mining or virtual currency. And this would be for loads above and below 5 megawatts and at 5 megawatts, all levels. And during that moratorium, we would do the work to review and update rate schedule 35, which is the less than 5 megawatt schedule, including that transmission element for upfront charges. We'd continue to develop the over 5 megawatt process, which we're actively doing right now, and the rates associated with it. We look for any areas which we, you know, do on an ongoing basis to update our service regulations and consider any of those necessary planning standards, processes, and procedures associated with that. We would also be reviewing and modifying fees and charges for unauthorized loads. A moratorium isn't going to change that. In fact, it could make it increase in the short term at least. And then a widespread communication of those consequences that we put in place for unauthorized operation. Just because we see or hear customers come in and say, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know I was supposed to do that or whatnot. So we want to make sure to get the word out there. We would continue our outreach with the local municipalities, the state, the county, all the building code officials, making sure that, you know, safe operations continue, that we're not putting anyone at risk out there from that aspect. And then continuing to advance our technologies. We've talked in the past about AMI in the future and the ability to really monitor and understand cryptocurrency loads on our system. So with that, maybe I'll say open for questions now before we.
I'd like to add one other quick thought. I think you know, a reasonable question would be, so how long do you think you'll be in a moratorium state? And the answer really depends on two things. First of all, I think there's a difference between the under 5 megawatt and the above 5 megawatt. We put a lot of time and effort into thinking through the under 5 megawatt. We're more advanced on that than we are in the above 5 megawatt. So I would anticipate likely there would be a difference between those. But the second and more difficult issue is the extent to which we're willing to compromise the existing underlying district performance plan, the work that we have to do. We're already trying to get done. There's always going to be a balance here between trying to address these new loads as they come in versus all of the work that we had going on. But what we're finding is that we are, in fact, leading the country on this. We're getting a lot of requests from utilities around the country for how we put these things in place. So we're struggling with the fact that there isn't another model for us to look to that helps us to understand what's the right way to address this problem. And it's leading us to a place where we're going to have to, again, make some choices with respect to how much of that plowing groundwork are we going to do and how much impact will it have on the fact that whereas many other parts of the country that are dealing with this problem do not have load growth, we do. So they're able to potentially be able to address underutilized assets, then be able to put them in play. And we don't have that problem. Our problem is that our assets are being fully utilized and being grown into. And we're struggling with the how are we going to build infrastructure to be able to address the amount of load that we're looking at. So with that, turn it back to Commission for any questions they may have.
Commissioners?
I just have a question on the motion. So the proposed motion would set in play a public hearing that would take place on the in May 14th, is that right? So the motion today would be the moratorium would go in effect today.
Correct.
With a public hearing on the 14th of May.
Correct. Okay. So the model that we followed in the past is we would impose the moratorium and then we would set a public hearing to consider the next steps. And my anticipation, Commissioner, would be that we would come back on that date, report to the board what had occurred, and frankly, hear any questions from the board or public, but also to give you sort of the roadmap or the next peek at the next part of the roadmap that we're working on so that we can keep you and the public updated on the steps that we're taking to get the right processes, rates, fees, charges in place so that we can lift the moratorium eventually.
Thank you.
Just a comment. Last week, Gary and I were at PUD Association meetings, and we always have a commissioner roundtable at those meetings. And I'm sure you're aware that the Bitcoin folks are not picking on just us. They've been in contact with Benton County, with Grays Harbor County, with Chelan, of course, Douglas and Grant, and probably the biggest requests have come in Grant County, probably because there's good land available. That and we've been reading the articles from around the nation. Wall Street Journal and others, that this, I mean, sometimes you really don't like being on the cutting edge, Steve. but we are, and so I, you know, we do need time to take a deep breath and work through some of the issues here, and this may be the best approach.
I thought a couple of things for me. It was interesting to hear about what we're learning. You know, we went off the moratorium that we first set, and now we've learned some things since we've been working on that. And I think it's really time to step back and put the moratorium on again and revisit what we've learned and the impacts of that. I think that's really important. I guess one of the questions that I have, too, I'd really like to go back. Those who haven't involved the process, I guess I'm a little irritated with the fact that we've got people out there pushing the limits and not following the process, and we need to step back, or they need to step back and deal with the consequences of not following that process. And I'm not real patient with that. So I guess I just want that to be known. You know, anyway, there are consequences for not following that. So I think those were my two ahas in this, and in reinforcing the need to move, support the staff's recommendation.
Gary?
I'd just like to chime in and say one more thing, that as you were giving your presentation today, and certainly as we were looking at the meters and how fast that they were turning, it just once again calls into my mind the whole automated metering, making it a far easier way to check when the system's being gamed, when people are breaking the rules. And so I circle back. There's many, many dots that need to be connected here, and I see that as one that once again points to the importance of the automated meter.
Couple of questions, and I'm probably, Eric, referring to you in terms of a motion. It's similar in some ways of, you know, when you look at Robert's Rules of Orders, when you're tabling something whether it would be indefinite or definite. And I'm not seeing any time definition in here. So it makes me wonder in terms of wording. I know we can't be indefinite, definitely. But so are we looking for a definite time, which could always be extended, or so, an indefinite, and see where that takes?
Yeah, so the way it currently is framed, Commissioner, is that it would be immediately effective, and that would be up for consideration at the public hearing in May.
May, okay.
And then in May, there would be either a decision to come out of the moratorium or to continue that moratorium until another update date certain. So like last time, this is the same process we followed.
Right.
We will do it from time to time in order to keep not only the board updated on the work that the staff has been doing, but that public piece available as well, to provide the opportunity for comment, input, and also to advise as to the steps that we're taking, just for transparency purposes. So it's actually a process that we have used before. It's the same, similar to the process that the cities use when they impose a moratorium. So at this point in time, the motion is framed to carry forward to the May date that's set out for a public hearing, at which time the board will take whatever action the board believes is appropriate.
Okay. So we can keep moving that forward, but we know that ultimately we have to make a decision that we cannot use the length of time as a issue in perpetuity.
So the intent is to accomplish all of those things the staff has been suggesting to you today during this period of time, and the intent is to show you that path at these interim check-ins.
Okay.
So it is not intended, if the question is it intended to be just a prohibition for an indefinite period of time? The answer is no.
Right.
It's intended to really provide the deep breath necessary to address all of these questions, concerns, risks that we now find ourselves facing, either new for the above five or revisiting for the under five. I do think it's important to remind the board and the public that when we adopted the HDL rate and came out of the moratorium in the last instance, and we did advise the board as part of that that we would be using the time to evaluate the assumptions, I think, that led to the creation of that rate based upon the actual data that we would have during the following year. And we've now got some of that data and found that some of these issues need to be at least revisited for either confirmation or alteration. And then quite simply, commissioners, we don't have a process and have not really had one for the over five.
Okay. Thank you. That helps. Any other comments or questions? Just one other item, and I'm again asking from a legal perspective.
Yeah, I think
I'm sorry. Ann, do you have a comment? My mistake for just rambling on.
I do. Hold on.
Okay. Please go ahead.
Okay. Hopefully there won't be too much interference. So just kind of first of all, I definitely support putting a moratorium in place. I felt for quite a while that we need to do that so that we can do all the, you know, with the changing landscape, do all the analysis. But I guess and I'll be quick. My big picture thoughts on this are that, you know, we've worked really hard. We have, our customers have, at conservation. And in fact, we're mandated to meet conservation goals. And we've done that. In fact, we've exceeded those conservation goals. And so it just seems, to me, doesn't really compute when you look at these really large load requests. And for the most part, they don't provide jobs or very little jobs, and there's not much capital investment. And so that just kind of runs counter to what our whole focus and what our, what our goal has been, which is to conserve power and be really efficient with our use of power. So that's just kind of my big picture thoughts. And I know we have a duty to serve, but we need to we need to do it really responsibly. So thanks for that.
May I comment?
Yes, please, Eric.
So Commissioner Congdon, thank you for that. This is Eric. So I just remind us that the duty to serve is not absolute. We get to set all of those processes and the conditions for service. So certainly that does not obligate us to turn anyone on today or even tomorrow. We need to get the process right so that we're impacting all of our customers. And the follow-on comment I wanted to make in response to your comments, Commissioner Congdon, is that is indeed one of the issues that's been identified. I don't want to speak for Greg Carrington's group, but they have been vocal about the fact that we need to consider the impact of some of these loads, particularly the larger loads, on our conservation obligations and how we ensure that they are contributing to that in the fashion that's correct.
A couple of things. Just one is that, and again, it's a legal question. I'm not looking for an answer now. But we have some people, it appears, who are willing to commit fraud, purposefully ignoring our policies and rate schedules. You know, I guess... What if it fits into a criminal situation where it might be necessary to enforce it, and who would be the enforcement agency? It's kind of like, you know, perhaps a statement here or there that trespassers will be prosecuted. I know that's not the right term, but, you know, the similar kind of an idea. And then secondly, just another question, as we roll this thing out and develop, you know, our response to this, is this proprietary or is it in the public domain in terms of the solution? So again, not answers that I need right now, but just something that I'd like to ask and have some understanding of.
Fair enough. So the only response I'll give you right now, Commissioner, I'll reserve the others, is that we aren't the body that determines what is or isn't criminal.
Right.
You know, we do in the past report on what we consider to be energy theft. The most common example that I can think of is when someone is tapped in ahead of the meter in order to, you know, formally anyway, facilitate an unlawful grow operation of marijuana or something, right. Some other unauthorized use. We do report those when we find them. The, you know, the municipals, the state legislature, and the cities are the ones that set the criminal codes, and they would be the ones that would decide whether or not there was a violation of any particular criminal code. And we might also have civil remedies available as well.
Okay.
So,
all right.
The rest I'll opine on later.
Okay. Thank you. Any other thoughts or questions?
We ready for a motion?
Yeah.
Mr. President, I would move to adopt a moratorium on accepting any new electric service applications for further processing any existing electric service applications for proposed computing or data processing loads related to virtual or cryptocurrency mining, Bitcoin, or any similar purpose, whether above 5 megawatts pursuant to Schedule 4 or at or below 5 megawatts pursuant to Schedule 35 or any other schedule. The moratorium would not apply to approved applications that have fully paid all line extension estimates and upfront capital charges. Further, direct staff to prepare an appropriate confirming resolution for consideration at the next board meeting. Finally, setting a public hearing on the moratorium at 1 p.m. May 14, 2018 in Wenatchee, as part of the regular commission meeting for further consideration of the moratorium.
Is there a second?
A second.
Okay. In lieu of time, instead of repeating the motion, we have a motion before us. Is there discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor of adopting a moratorium as described, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is unanimous.
Thank you,
Commissioner. Unanimously accepted. Thank you. Thank you guys very much. And I can't say how grateful we are as a commission related to our staff and your willingness to work through all of this. We appreciate your patience, your knowledge, and your experience. and we need to get Andy out in front taking a few more shots. But other than that, it's good. Allison, Steve, thanks for coming. Appreciate it. How to clear out a room, huh?
People in the back of the room that came in and then left.
Okay. Assume we're ready to move on.
Yes.
Okay. So, item
just now.
Yeah.
Six, facilities plan update.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So, do we have a question?
No, wait.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So recall that we've been doing a lot of work for the last couple of years on strategic facilities plan. And last year, we separated the hydro facilities from the non-hydro facilities and said we're going to have different implementation strategies for these. So we took a step forward with one building that we needed to get working on immediately, the storage building down at Rock Island. But our goal has been to bring you a package of hydro support facilities. And today we take an important step in that regard. And in addition, we'll be proposing for you an innovative approach, at least with respect to Chelan PUD, for how we would go about contracting for that. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dan Frazier to lead us through this.
Morning, Commissioners. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services. So we're here today. We've brought in two of our consultants, Randy Cook from TCF Architecture and Jim Dugan from Parametrics. And we really have a kind of a twofold update for you today. The first part is truly an update. What we've been doing on our hydro support facilities part of the facilities plan project. So we've had some initial design work. We're working through the even execution, as Steve referenced, on one of the facilities, one of the buildings. And then the rest of the presentation is about this alternate project delivery that we've been talking about. And we've kind of hit just on a very high level at some of the implementation plan meetings about what it was. We'll get into a much deeper understanding of why we're thinking about doing this, what it actually is, and then what a timeline would be going forward to execute under this. It's called the GCCM, General Contractor Construction Manager Form. So with that, it is only this morning session is no action, discussion, questions. And with that, I'll turn it over to Randy. Oh, actually, they gave me a new assignment right before this meeting. I forgot that. So the next slide here, this is something that actually has been, you've seen this several times, and we keep coming back to these core goals as a guiding, this is our compass that guides us on everything we've been doing as far as decision making and as we work in toward design and execution. These five core goals for the project. And it's productivity. We want to maximize our operational productivity. We want to provide those service levels, and these are service levels to our customers and also into our internal clients and customers, providing the best financial value long term. So everything we've been doing goes back to a net present value, a long-term value. Cost predictability, and while that sounds a little bit like financial value, it's more about that we know what it's going to take as we go forward to continue to maintain these facilities so we don't get caught behind the eight ball again several years from now that we are not adequately maintaining our facilities. So knowing exactly what we're going to be spending in years to come. And then finally, safety. We really need to be able to create facilities that give us the opportunity to give the best safety for both our workers and the public. So we continue to use these five guiding core goals as we embark on all these next phases of the project. So with that, I'll turn that over.
All right. Good to be back again. Randy Cook with TCF Architecture. So I'll give you a brief tour. And, of course, I know everybody here made some tours of the facilities last winter. I think you had a particularly snowy day for it, which was good to see just how everything performs in the dead of winter. This first slide is the Rock Island Master Plan. When we went through all of the analysis work over the last couple of years, we made a lot of early assumptions about square footage, building functions, and so forth. This is the latest generation of the earlier site plans that you would have seen. And if I just kind of zoom in, this right side is the top of the hill. If you remember walking through the crew building, that's C5 over here. And everything you see in a color is a new building. As was just mentioned a moment ago, this is the new 20,000 square foot storage building, which is under construction right now with a separate team. But we've incorporated it into the overall master plan where in the center here, what's called C22 is the new shop and warehouse facility. This is where a The large components will be brought in for blasting and painting. There's a high bay workspace. There's also low bay fabrication shops and warehousing. And that's really one of the key components of this, is to get that productivity as one of those core goals. It's to get the powerhouse to functions on the Chelan side of the river. And so up here, it's actually this orange portion of C-22 is a new warehouse and tool room. So everything associated with Powerhouse 2, the crews will be able to access on this side of the river, and if not completely eliminate, almost, very dramatically reduce the trips that are going across the deck. And that's really one of the primary components of our analysis. Also, there's a new crew building up here. This is really a large locker room space. This is where you begin and end your day if you're a crewman or any staff at Rock Island. And C-5 will eventually be turned over to the rehab contractor. So we're trying to find the sweet spot of reusing buildings where we can best reuse them. We're not going to put a lot of money into some of these other storage buildings, but they'll remain because they're still useful, and really putting our best foot forward with these other buildings. Down on what we call the deck level, the lower Chelan area, there's a new C-19. This will be a two-story office building on the upper floor for the rehab engineering team that are currently on the Douglas side. And then the lower level of that is a common break room, lunch room, gathering, training room, space for 120 or so people in there. This now gathers together all the disparate smaller spaces that are kind of spread around the site and brings everybody together in a single place, and that would be happening here in C-19. And then we're reusing C-14 and C-13, so again, we're trying to use the buildings that are existing and put the right amount of investment in them so they can continue to function into the future, but also turn over certain buildings to the rehab contractor. And the other one would be C-11, which is the current blast building at Rock Island. That would be turned over to the rehab contractor as his deck level space, where he can have a certain amount of material and tools and workspace in there while his crews are up on top of the hill. So that's the Chelan side. On the Douglas side, pretty much everything happening there will happen inside the envelope of the buildings. So there's HVAC work, electrical work, maybe a little bit of exterior work on roofing and so forth, but we're not doing any site work over there. It's pretty much going to be taking the buildings as is and giving them some new life. Okay. Over at Rocky Reach, go to the next slide. And I know you've toured here as well, so to orient you, we've got some letters for the buildings here that were more for our internal purposes, but you toured through what's also known as C-17 or CM-17, which is the main original shop building. That building will be repurposed, continue to be a fabrication shop, but also bringing over the warehousing and the tool room, which are on the other side of the driveway right now, and putting everything in one building. That's really the most efficient way to have the crews working, is when your tools are right there by your fab shop, and all of your warehousing, which is all under the purview of the warehouse group, everything in one building there. You also may remember these modular buildings like the one here. There's two of them out there. These are some pretty decrepit buildings. They're in very bad shape. All of the office functions will be brought together in a single new building, the blue building here. And the crew spaces, which are on the lower level of C-17 right now, will be brought over to a new crew building, very similar to Rock Island's. The rest of the buildings, again, kind of like Rock Island, we want to reuse what we can reuse, put some investment into those in HVAC and electrical and so forth. The building frames are usually in pretty good shape. They're pre-engineered steel buildings. In some cases, we'll get some new roofing on them or some new siding, some new colors, and what we want to do is really create the next generation of what Rocky Reach will have as their support facilities, all kind of like a main street almost here. And one of the other key functions is to get these items that are in the center of the site right now moved to the south, which is the fueling island and some of these other small buildings, because right now it's a very congested circulation zone in there, as you remember from your tour. So there'll be a new fuel island, and then way south on the site, a smaller blast building. A lot of the gate work happens in the plant, as you may know, but this is also a new blast building that will be up to current code standards for ventilation, pollution control, and so forth. And a smaller version of the storage building that you see at Rock Island would also be down here at Rocky Reach. You may also know, if you've been out there recently, there's a very large tent structure that went up this past year, and they're using that for a lot of other storage, which is great, and we're just leaving that alone. That'll just stay in the center of the site there. Okay. So that's your very quick tour through both the sites. The next two slides.
You mentioned the decrepit buildings on the lower left picture there. Where are those located?
So this picture, you can't quite see it. It would be off to the left. It's right down in front of the plant, that particular one. The other one is right up here, which is currently sitting just right around in here. And it's going to also be removed. Those are old modular buildings. They're going to go away.
Okay. Yep.
There's a lot of microphasing that has to happen at Rocky Reach, even more so than Rock Island, to make all these moves happen. Okay. So schedule-wise, on the top is the Rock Island schedule. So 2018, right now we are in the very beginning of detailed design. So we've come from an analysis phase where we've made a lot of preliminary assumptions. We're now spending more time with the crews in detailed design workshops. And in fact, we're expecting comments back this week from a presentation a couple of days we had last week, where the floor plans are starting to come together now, and the guys are seeing exactly where all their equipment's going to lay out. They're seeing how the lockers are going to lay out. They're able to comment, and that'll give us the next gate to go through in order to go through into final design. So 2018 is all about finishing design, permitting, and getting us up to the point where the contractor can actually start work, which Jim will talk about in a minute. 2019 is the build year, and as we know, with the Powerhouse 2 contractor coming on board in early 2020, we need to be off the site in 2019. So there's microphasing in this one as well, but really you've got this year and next year, and that's what everything is geared to right now. The lower system here is the Rocky Reach schedule. It's stretched out further. 2018, we will probably get after some earlier pre-design and some other early site investigation work later this year, with 2019 being our year for design and permits. And 2020 through 2021 really being the build years to create what you saw in that plan just a moment ago. So it's a little more stretched out than Rock Island. What this allows us to do is everyone, including the district's staff resources, my own staff resources, move from one project to the next. And then we just have this staggered set of schedules happening. Oh, go back.
Also on the 2018, there's also a large site work package that's goes with that heated storage. We have to provide utilities to that storage building, and then we're doing also all the utilities for the other buildings on the site. So there will be a rather large for us a site work package. So it's water, power, wastewater, all stormwater, all those things. It'll be later this year.
Right. Yep. And fire flow. Fire flow is a big deal at both sites. So there's a lot happening there. Very briefly then on cost analysis for Rock Island, we have a current budget or an estimate range between 38, 39 million. This is what we're working on now as we go through this next stage of detailed design, is where we can make a lot of value choices. Got a lot of work to do right now. Our entire team is engaged. So all of my engineers, structural, mechanical, electrical, civil, everybody is working now to find the best value between site work and building work in order to bring this project in on budget. The number you see to the right is the difference in the net cost. So if you remember, we did the analysis that demonstrated putting all of our assumptions in over the next, in this case, 25-year period. And in that, we ran two scenarios. There was the status quo scenario that is more geared to how the district has typically done buildings in the past, which is very stretched out, more piecemeal, versus doing a more compact, master-planned, get-it-done process. And the difference between those two in net present cost is about $3.7 million. So while we're going to continue to work on this number by making good value choices to try to bring the best value to the district in every single design decision that's made, we're going to be continuing to see a difference in doing it on the schedule that we're doing it and doing it in a master planned way to be in this $3+ million range and versus what you would do if you went the other direction. Likewise at Rocky Reach, again, this one is stretched out further. There's a little more cost over at Rocky Reach. We don't have quite as dramatic a difference between the net present cost, but we still have a positive savings that's happening there. And again, that's going to be something as we get into design next year on that one. We're going to be doing the same thing, getting our team to go through a process of best value on buildings and site costs, try to keep that to the lower end of the range, obviously. And the difference here is getting this done through 2022 rather than stretching it out to, you know, another 8- and 10-year period, which is really what the more status quo approach would look like.
And we'll be able to track that, get reports on that.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. As we go through each design phase, there's new rounds of detailed estimating that'll be done. And actually, this gets to some of what Jim will talk about in the delivery process, is working with the general contractor on that as we move forward. Okay. Other questions before we move on to Jim? All right.
Good morning. Jim Dugan with Parametrics. We're going to talk a little bit about alternative project delivery today. And specifically to the general contractor construction manager delivery. But first, let's talk about why even do that. So over the last 5, 6, 7 years and in the Washington State region and specifically along the I-5 corridor, we've had such a robust market. I've never seen it, never seen so much work and so few contractors. I'm 61 now, going in my fifth decade, and it's the most robust I've ever seen. And K-12 alone pumped more than $13 billion into the construction market just in the last 5 or 6 years. So what we're seeing are costs that are screaming, 8, 9, 10% more expense on drywall and concrete. I have no idea what tariffs will do to steel. Neither does the marketplace. Glass, last year we ran out of glass, and then we had glass contractors that were on strike, and we were opening buildings with plywood windows. I mean, it's... the marketplace is robust. And when you think about that and you think about the fact that we have essential facilities that have to remain operational, there are no impacts to hydro generation, then it makes us think maybe the adversarial relationship of a design, bid, build, delivery might not be the best way to manage our risk. So what is it? There's a lot of acronyms here. I'm going to try and remember to say them all. And if I forget, one of these two fine gentlemen will remind me, but Alternative Project Delivery, APD, is defined by the Revised Codes of Washington, Section 39.10. And it was developed just for these kinds of conditions where a public agency using public funds wants to think about procuring construction services differently than just the bid market. The legislature appoints the Capital Project Advisory Review Board, so I'll refer to that as CPARB. They appoint CPARB. CPARB administers over a number of different functions, which includes the appointment of the Project Review Committee. This committee, of which I'm a member, there are about 30 of us, we hear, read the applications and hear the presentations for every public agency in the state that wants to use a different delivery method than just design, bid, build. So you're going to see DB, design, build, progressive design, build, GCCM, that we think of them as tools in a tool belt, and the statutes clearly state what the criteria are for you to satisfy if it is a way to deliver a project that is better for you, better to manage risk. If selecting someone on qualifications, someone that you want to get married to for a long period of time, a relationship-based environment, then the bid market doesn't do it, and this does. And it actually causes you as a team, owner, builder, design team, project management team, to work in a very integrated and collaborative way right from the very beginning. So we're going to talk about a couple of methods, just some pros and cons. So design, bid, build, by default, is what all public agencies have the authority to use at any time. It's familiar. It's 100% bid, accepted by the public. Probably its biggest flaw is that the lowest bid does not equate to the lowest cost. It never did. Because design isn't perfect, sorry, Randy, design isn't perfect, then there will always be imperfections in design, and so it creates an adversarial relationship right out of the gate. It's not collaborative. Risks are borne by the owner. And at least from my standpoint, from a project management standpoint, the only cost estimate that really, really matters is the one that comes from the contractor when we get ready to sign a contract, and everything else is everybody trying to guess what it's going to cost. So in an inflation market, it's really important to bring your builder on as soon as you can to find out what your real costs are so we can validate the estimates done so far. Compared to that, General Contractor Construction Manager. This is a role where the construction manager can do up to 30% of self-performing their own work. It's a process where you have qualifications, interview, and a final price selection process. It's an iterative process. You'll see a line here that says dial in scope and cost to budget. So the goal is to constantly lower the budget total by gaining efficiencies working with one builder on multiple projects. But while you set those budgets in an inflationary market, is to be able to value engineer and value analyze all the way to the time you turn over each one of these buildings, which is going to be throughout the whole process. So you still warrant the design as an owner. You do have three contracts, one for pre-construction services during design, one for construction services. And between those two, if for some reason the contractor that comes on board here, if we decide we don't want to take them to construction, 3910 allows you to off-ramp. You'll see that fourth or fifth bullet that's up above to be able to put your documents out on the street and bid them if you want to. So you have that opportunity. Next. Yeah, wrong direction. So additional benefits. We need a partner to help us manage the marketplace, to be able to bring us in on budget, to ensure that Powerhouse 2 starts, whether that be the first of 2020, but at a minimum, we complete in December of 2019. We need certainty on that. We can't miss that. In the K-12 market of $30 to $50 million projects, for the first time in a half a century, we're not able to open schools on the first day of school, because it takes longer, materials aren't available, labor forces don't show up. There's a lot of complications in the marketplace. So to build in that certainty, thinking differently, a way for us to manage that risk is to look at this method of delivery, to be able to partner up and go about these two very important projects, these two essential projects. Next. So to give you those options, there's a prescribed schedule with the Project Review Committee for when applications are due to the state of Washington. Most recent due date was February 20th. We submitted the application for Rocky Reach and Rock Island to bring on one GCCM contractor. Even when approved, we cannot use it if we so choose, but if we didn't submit, you wouldn't have that option. So we got the document submitted. We're going to actually be presenting this Thursday. So the process is you present your application, then you come in on the prescribed date, and you present to an 8-member team of the Project Review Committee. And no, I don't actually have to sit on both sides of that table. I'll be presenting to my peers on behalf of you to gain permission, which is granted that day, if granted, to use the GCCM delivery method, if you so choose. These dates are the dates that are actually published in the or written into the RFP that, when published, become the dates for the process of procurement. So you'll see proposals for qualifications that will be due on the 12th, interviews on the 26th, the pricing portion on May 11th. And what you're going to see here, if you do the math between those dates, this moves pretty quick. So quick that by about May 16th, which is a really important time for us to bring a contractor on board to begin working immediately on an early assistant services contract while we negotiate their pre-construction services, to start validating costs and be thinking about critical phasing. Have we thought about the best phasing? Is there another way to phase it differently to be able to get more done in less time? But this is the current procurement process that lies ahead of us, if so adopted. And this Thursday, Sam and Dan and Randy and I will be presenting to the state of Washington.
I'd like to add a couple things. Well, presenting if you approve today, so that's critical. We need the board to say that they are interested in this, or else that board, the one in Olympia, will not be very interested in hearing about our proposal. So very critical your view on this. Second thing I'd like to say is, so when you think about the way we currently manage projects under state law, you basically establish a budget estimate very early in the process before you know very much, and then you manage to that budget. And I would argue at least that that is not consistent with best for the most for the longest, because when you're managing only to a budget number and you're not thinking about quality and trade-offs in terms of where might I be able to create more value for a customer, as we learn more and go through the process, that's left out really in this process. At least it's not very amenable to being able to understand those kinds of things. So taking a shot at this different kind of process, to me, feels a lot more consistent with best for the most for the longest than what we're currently doing.
And just so you don't think you're out there alone, Grant County PUD used the progressive design build. So they went through the same process. They went to the project review committee and asked for approval to do that a couple years ago. And they have successfully completed a multi-substation suite of projects. And we are actually downloading with their staff, going through their lessons learned. They've had a very robust lessons learned. And they said they got a lot of value out of it. But they could have gotten more value if they really understood it. So they want to help us make those right choices as we go forward. Yes, it's a slightly different process, but the idea of this collaboration versus the adversarial relationship. So it's definitely, we would be the first PUD that would do a GCCM project, but there are others that have done alternate delivery. So.
And Tacoma Water with their, Green River water filtration plant. I think they went through a process very similar to that for GCCM. And then also K-12, the very first design-build public school in the state of Washington. It's going on now in Tacoma. For the very reason of getting the most value for the longest haul in an inflationary market with fixed budgets. It's a first. That hands-off release in the design-build world should be a test for K-12. Another GCCM. And there's quite, in fact, sitting on the project review committee over the last 10 years ago, GCCM was a really good idea that lots of people talked about maybe wanting to try. And today, it consumes the project review committee. Today, design build, beginning to talk about that the same way. So we're going to see over time, as cost goes up, available materials gets more expensive, and the demand for new facilities continues. We're going to look at lots of different ways to deliver.
Commissioners, thoughts, comments, questions?
Yes. I'm struggling with one aspect of this. I have made a history of the last 11 years as a commissioner not getting a presentation and approving it the same day, period. That's an issue. It's a process issue. Everything you've talked about, you've convinced me that this is good, but we have a public that we're accountable to. And things like this need to see the light of day, have a couple of weeks, and we come back and we can do approval. So that, for me, that's a huge burden right now, right here. Other than that, you've convinced me, but we have an obligation to a public.
So a couple of thoughts about that. Number one, normally this could go just on the resolution component. We decided to pull it off and bring it in because we think it is different. And so for that reason, we've kind of pulled it and made it unique in terms of providing a study session. You have many opportunities, though, to stop this project. This is the first step in terms of releasing an RFP, so we can learn more. We can find out whether the board is interested in our approach or not, and willing to give us the authority to move forward. You have the ability to stop the process anytime, certainly up until the RFP is completed and we accept the bid. So there are going to be multiple opportunities for the board to choose to come back in. And if you've thought about it more and you think, no, I'm not really comfortable with this, or you get public comment that says not really comfortable with this, for you to be able to take an action at really modest cost to us. So not something that would cause us to say it's not worth it because we've invested so much money. So we feel like the option is still there for you. But if we miss this window, we're going to lose a couple of months on the schedule. And again, in this bidding environment, it could be more costly for us. So for that reason, we felt like we could balance the board's prerogative to be able to choose to make decisions based on more public comment if it wants to come in, with being able to keep the project moving forward.
That gives me much greater comfort.
Yeah, Commissioner, if I could support Steve's comment, it's really that June 5th date, I think, that is the one that is going to be critical for the board. And actually, I would argue that a lot of the information that we're going to find between now and that date is going to be the kind of information that the public and the board is going to want to see and be able to digest before it makes that June 5th. The action today is really for the value of CPARB and the Project Review Committee to show the board's support for the alternative for exploring using an alternative methodology, and it's critical to the acceptance, I think, to have that support. But really what it amounts to in a comparative in our typical world is merely the board authorizing the release of a request for proposal, which says, give me information that I can use to later make a decision about whether I'm going to commit the district to a contract. Okay. So I think that there will be a long opportunity for that comment, and you as a board will see a lot of that information that will be then available to you and the public to make the decision. I think the critical one is going to be the June. Is that fair?
That's correct. And the language, if I may, that we actually have written in the RFP is, at any time for any reason, the owner, at the sole discretion of the owner, may augment, edit, or change or cancel the procurement process, if full rights and authority.
And that's what you deem the off-ramp opportunity? Is that correct?
The off-ramp is specifically chosen those words between pre-construction and construction, where you finished one contract and you're getting ready to go to the next. So that's actually separate. This is actually just a right and authority given to you that we write right into the RFP, so that as we learn more, as we see who's actually interested in this work and you, and how is the market behaving over the course of these next couple of months, it gives us lots of information to make those decisions.
So I guess the point that I was making that might alleviate we can begin that process, which is new, and then if that we learn that we're not comfortable with that, then you off-ramp it later and go to it.
That's correct.
Yeah,
that's correct. Absolutely.
So, and we, commissioners, for point of information, we have that language in all of our bids, RFPs, whatever procurement methodology we start a road. This is no different than what we would typically have. If we decide for any reason at all that we want to cancel a bid or an RFP, we can do that.
So the resolution that will be here this afternoon addresses two things. One is that support, shows this, the PRC, the Project Review Committee, that we do support doing the additional exploration to see if this is right for us. And then the second part is allowing us to put an RFP on the street, then to test the market to see if we have contractors interested. So it's really just going to that next level of exploration.
Okay. I guess in terms of supporting Randy's concern, I think we ought to honestly take lessons learned on this, because I just don't like a presentation in the morning and a vote in the afternoon, period. The public deserves better from this commission than that, and that would be the expectation of staff. And so even if we're having this conversation, is an indication that, at least in my mind, that we have not followed our protocol, and we need to ensure the public trust, particularly on expenditures ultimately, that we're going to follow that protocol. And I guess I would encourage us to go ahead and, you know, have the meeting later this week, the presentation, and tell me what's wrong with coming back and approving the resolution on April 2nd.
Well, my understanding, at least, is that the board wants to hear that this board is supportive of moving forward. Is that correct?
It is correct. We're exploring it. So sitting on the project review committee, when we hear a new client to the public process of alternative delivery, the question generally gets asked, as it should, does the governing body of this owner actually know that you're here, actually know that you're here with their approval presenting, and a resolution that says that you know that your Chelan County PUD is presenting to the state on that day, it just checks a box for the PRC members.
Okay.
And really nothing more.
So would it be sufficient to have a motion of support along that line and do a formal resolution on the 2nd? And again, you know, I can say, you know, personally, you know, I am interested in this process and I am supportive of this process. It's just a protocol issue for us, and my apology for not connecting for whatever reason, Resolution 11 with the March 22nd date. And I'll accept full responsibility for not making that connection and not asking the question until today. So that's a mistake on my part. But I want our public to have an opportunity to weigh in. My guess is, honestly, we probably will not hear a thing, but the public deserves that opportunity. Is that And I need to know where my fellow commissioners are.
That's what I've been struggling with, Dennis.
Good.
Exactly that. And
so my only concern with that is if you look at the so let me back up and say the board acts in two ways, by motion, by resolution. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with you taking action by resolution or by motion. So if that was the choice that you selected, that would be okay. The real issue is timing.
Right.
My understanding is if you what the resolution really does is approves the issuance of the RFP, assuming that it is approved as a application on Thursday, right? And my understanding is that the need, but I'm so this is a first for Chelan PUD, right? We're specifically statutorily authorized to use this alternative delivery method. We've not done so before, so Jim and Randy have been very helpful in explaining that process. So my understanding is the intent would be to issue the RFP effectively the day after approval, so Friday.
That's correct.
So I don't know if you the only way you could do it would be to move to approve the presentation on Thursday, or I suppose move to approve the RFP, but then you would be simply ratifying on April 2nd what you'd already approved. It's April 2nd, right?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what you'd already approved, and it would not, in my view, accomplish the outcome that you're looking for, which I presume from your comments is an opportunity for the public to come and object and say, I don't want you to explore this alternative, right? So I don't know what the time requirement is for issuance of the RFP and the rolling impact of that delay on all of the other timelines set forth in the presentation.
Let's see if I can offer some information. RCW 3910 does not have a mandatory date for issuance of the RFP. In fact, you could actually have this approved by them on Thursday and then issue it a month later, 2 months later, 3 months later, from a statute standpoint, from a project standpoint. What we're proposing, and one of their requirements within the GCCM application, is to bring your contractor on board on or before the end of schematic design in order to ensure that the greatest amount of time to shape the project is available between the contractor and the design team. This is slightly different in that we have lots of buildings that design and build, design and build, design and build, so that's a little softer. It allows us a little more freedom than most projects, but there isn't a mandatory date. And in fact, what it would press, we wouldn't push out the June 5 date. It would merely compress the period between now and June 5. And one of the greatest risks is that our big contractors, Leidig, Skanska, Mortensen, Absher, BN Builders, they're choosing which projects they're going to go after, and they have a long list of projects every time they look. And they're looking for the ones that fit within their timeline, aren't too onerous, aren't asking for too much too fast in order to find that sweet spot. So we're guessing, but with some talent, on what that squeeze point is. And what you see in that schedule there is about as fast as we can do it without a greater concern that they'll just pick a $100 million project in North Seattle and not a $50 million project in Wenatchee. So it's just that. So between the PRC's mandatory schedule and the marketplace's sensitivity and trying to manage your risk to the greatest extent possible, it was to give you the most options possible, which was to hit the PRC's schedule. Mm-hmm. Let's get in. Let's get started. Let's develop information. and then let's back out or stay in any time between now and June 5, but to use that time then and not lose that time now. This is the best way I know how to describe it.
Okay.
Yeah, my point doesn't relate to anything you just said.
Right.
And that's really, really important.
Yes.
It's our process here.
Understood.
Yeah. You don't have to convince us of the need.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll move the microphone.
So, commissioners, what is your appetite?
So the resolution isn't actually before you until this afternoon. But if you want to reserve action until that time, that would be fine.
Yeah.
I need some thought process.
A little thought.
The opportunity, though, might expire by this afternoon to ask questions that might influence that outcome. So to the extent there's additional information or impacts that might influence you one way or the other, now's your time.
I personally, as one commissioner, I understand what you've described, and I'm very sympathetic to the timeline. On the other hand, though, I'm sympathetic to our methodology and systems here as commissioners and giving our constituents time to approach us, to vocalize on topics before we simply throw the switch. And so I thank you for your presentation. It's very well done. The explanation was quite clear. It's just a matter of wrestling with policy that we put in place that we've been comfortable with, and how do we reconcile that? And so I would appreciate some time to look at that resolution this afternoon, have a little time to maybe have some lunch and think about it.
I think your agenda provides you that opportunity.
Yeah, thank you.
Are we okay with that? And I think, again, I appreciate it very much, and I hope this isn't perceived as finger wagging or stumbling block or whatever. Commission always wants to be in a position of being defendable but not defensive. And if someone in the public comes to us and says, gosh, you heard it in the morning, you voted on it in the afternoon, how can you defend that? I'm not sure we can. Other than utilizing the logic that's been shared with us. And again, I find no fault in the logic. It's just simply that itchy spot that a commissioner has to scratch. So if you can give us, well, we do have till this afternoon anyway, but let us know that, we're just letting you know that there will be some individual contemplative behavior between now and then, and we'll make a decision this afternoon. So appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I think we're probably done.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. It's time to break.
Not quite.
Nope.
We have one other item.
I'd like to save that for this afternoon.
But, okay.
Something during lunch. I need to get done.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realize we were over. When you're having such a good day, yes, it goes.
Thanks, Case.
All right. Thank you. We'll adjourn for lunch. I'll be back at 1 o'clock. Thank you. Good afternoon and welcome to March 19th, 2018, Lane County PUD's Board of Commissioners. And it is now a couple of minutes after 1. We're starting our afternoon session, and we're going to deviate just a little bit from our agenda as agreed upon. And I'll turn the meeting over to General Manager Steve Wright.
Well, I'd like to make a proposal so we can hopefully finish off this morning's conversation. I think there's a way to be able to move forward that allows us to stay on schedule and get to the board, and at the same time be respectful of the commission's policy with respect to how to address resolutions. In talking with our team over the lunch hour, we believe that there is still a good chance we could be successful if the board were to not move forward with a resolution, but provide what has become a used protocol here of the head nod, that you're comfortable with the fact that you know what it is that we're doing, and that you're supportive of us going off and exploring the GCCM approach. It'll allow us to get more information about how the board reacts to our proposal and be able to bring it back, and we would bring the resolution back at the next meeting. So if that is comfortable with the board, I'd like to propose a modification where the resolution that's on for this afternoon session would be removed, and instead we just have this discussion right now, and get the head nod approval, the team will move forward.
Commissioners, your thoughts, please.
Well, since Ann can't see it, I got two thumbs up. So.
Okay. So there's a visual for you.
Yeah. I'm fine with that. Yeah.
Steve?
I am.
I am as well. Ann?
Yes.
Thank you. That's a, no pun intended, Ann, but that's a husky voice. Okay, it should have been a pun, but it wasn't a good one. All right. Okay. Satisfactory? All right.
We're good. Yep.
All right.
Thank you.
Nods all around. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Yes.
Would actually like to turn it over to the board president for our presentation.
Okay. It is my pleasure and prerogative as the board president to be able to give a 10-year pin in acknowledgement of excellent years of service. And by chance, I happen to wear mine today, so it means a lot to me. And I'm sure it will to Eric Walquist, our lead attorney. And it's been a little over 10 years now, I would assume, but close.
Thank you.
Yeah. And,
I'll get even with all of you after.
I'm sure you will.
I'm wearing mine, too, and it's just because the pride is there.
Yeah. So, Eric, thank you for your years of service. Thank you for the hours of work beyond compensation that you provide for us and the quality of that advice. I think your philosophy of law for this organization is as appropriate as it possibly could be. I know I do, and the other commissioners find you very approachable, offhand, to a certain extent as an attorney, so we don't get deeply into legalese, because you would lose all of us in that conversation instantly. But deeply indebted to where we are and as an organization, and appreciate your leadership tremendously.
Huh. It's been 10 years already. I don't want to blink. Well, I'll just say thank you. You know, I came here as a kid right out of law school, Wenatchee, 22 or 3 years ago now, and had the great pleasure of joining a law firm that had been the general counsel to this institution since literally its inception under Harvey Davis, and was immediately thrust into representation on any number of issues. The one that strikes me today is the CERCLA recoveries for the transformers that we had a hand in delivering to some of the Superfund sites across the state. And actually before that, at the U.S. Attorney's Office, we had actually prosecuted one of those that was here in Wenatchee at the old Deaconess Hospital facility.
Oh, gosh.
So it's been a long time, but it's been a privilege. So thank you all for the opportunity to be part of this family. The people that work here every day make this place what it is, and it's exceptional, the dedication and the time and the effort and energy spent toward the common mission. So yeah. I appreciate that, and I do promise to get even with each and every one of you after this.
Good.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, and thanks for your service. So moving on to the consent agenda, it's in front of you with the addition of Resolution 9. Commissioners, what are your wishes?
Would move approval of the consent agenda with the addition of Resolution 9.
Is there a second?
So moved.
It's been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda as presented with the addition of Resolution 9. Discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of accepting the consent agenda with the Resolution 9 added, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. So we will be moving to Resolution 11.
Ten.
Oh, I thought 10. Oh, I'm sorry. It's 11. Is 11 that we're?
11 has been pulled.
Okay, my mistake. So Resolution 10, please.
a resolution declaring Corridor Company Incorporated of Wakefield, Massachusetts as the sole source supplier of CM app software, authorizing the waiver of bidding requirements, and authorizing the district general manager to enter into contract with Corridor Company Incorporated. Craig Weddle is going to join us to talk about this.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Craig Weddles, supply chain and fleet manager. We have this software system we use in PCS called Bid Workflow. It's an old system that was built in-house over many, many years, and it's very, very old. It was built on technology that actually has not been supported since, I think, 2008. And I came in here in 2011, and discussions started before I got here to replace this software, and here we are finally. This software we're asking for approval is part of the replacement of Bid Workflow. We have been looking for a number of years, as you can imagine, at different options, evaluating different options for replacing this software. It basically supports everything we do in contracting at the district. It's our database. We do our reporting out of it. We track milestones. We use it for maintaining our contractor rosters and posting our bids online. It does everything we do in support of district contracts. There's literally nothing on the market in terms of software we can buy that does everything that this system does, because it was built over many, many years in-house to meet our needs. So what we've arrived at is two systems that are going to replace it. And one of the things we set out to do was to evaluate software systems that we already owned at the district to see if there's anything we could use that we'd already invested in. And lo and behold, we ended up with PeopleSoft. We have a contracts module in PeopleSoft that the district has owned for many years that we have never used. And we determined, along with our IT folks, that we can use that module for part of the replacement of Bid Workflow. And so essentially what we're going to do, with some modifications by our IT folks, we're going to be able to use that software we already own for maintenance of all of our contractor rosters, a small works roster, a high voltage electrical contractor roster, and our architect and engineers roster, for maintenance of those rosters, and also for our online bid posting, where we post our bid documents out online for contractors to be able to access them. So we're going to be able to use software we already own for all of that process. And then this CM app software that we're asking for approval today will support all of the rest of our contract management process. It'll become our database. We'll do a reporting out of it. We'll track tasks and milestones. The biggest thing that we're going to get out of it is document management. It's going to automate a lot of our preparation of our contract documents. It's going to provide some electronic workflow routing of our documents electronically for all of the various internal reviews that we do of our documents and approvals and such. So it's going to create some real efficiencies for us. A lot of things we do manually and do duplicate data entry and things on, it's going to automate for us. And it will interface. What's unique about it, why we're here as a sole source, is it runs on, it integrates with a software called SharePoint that the district already also owns and has made a lot of investment in for document management. So it uses the SharePoint technology, integrates with it for all of the document management and the workflow and things that we're going to be using it for. So it, again, is leveraging a technology that the district's already invested in to reduce our overall cost of this process. And that's something that's very unique with this software, and this Corridor company is the only one that sells it, so that's why we're here asking for that as a sole source. Want to just quickly give you the breakdown of the cost in the resolution. The not-to-exceed cost that we're asking for is $702,317. That covers 5 years, actually 5 years and 5 months of software licensing and support and maintenance by Corridor. So the first term of the contract will be actually 17 months. So the license that we'll pay for that first year, $80,712, will cover 17 months, so that they allow us a full 12 months of support after we've implemented and gone live with it. So we get 17 months out of that first term. And then it's annual terms after that, and the contract has a cap of not the increase on the annual costs is no more than 5% per year. And then we also have $213,333 for implementation costs. So they will come on site, work with us, We'll do some workshops initially to fine-tune the scope of work and some of the interfaces that we're working on to interface it with our other systems. And so that covers all that implementation cost. And then we've got $43,000 of contingency money for unexpected things. We've got a couple technical details still to work out with a couple of our interfaces. So we got a little bit of contingency money into that. And so that's how we get to the total of $702,000, but it covers a full 5 years of the licensing, support, and maintenance of the software, plus the implementation. Any questions?
Commissioners?
I just think it's amazing you've got a piece of software that's lasted that long and you're still using it.
We're having issues. There's a few things that are starting to not work, but nothing that's been a showstopper yet. So we're anxious to get this done.
Yeah, I'm sure. So.
Yeah, Mark Belton was up here with me at Preagen, and he described it as stone and chisel. So yeah.
There's a picture.
Yeah.
Anything else, commissioners? Craig, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioners, we have Resolution 11. Excuse me, 10 in front of us. What would you like to do?
I'll move to approve resolution number 10, declaring Corridor Company, Inc. of Wakefield, Massachusetts as a sole source supplier of CM app software, authorizing the waiver of bidding requirements, and authorizing the district's general manager to enter into a contract with Corridor Company, Inc.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to accept Resolution 10 as presented. Discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of accepting Resolution 10 as presented signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried. I think we're at item 12.
We are. So we've been moving towards being more focused on strategy for this board, and this next presentation is really in the form of a strategic discussion. I want to invite Brian Bradshaw to come up. There are a lot of things happening in the market, a lot of things that are causing prices to decline in the market, and we wanted to take a little bit of time here and just describe to you the things that we're seeing that are happening out there. No action is required on this today, but it's really a chance for you to be informed about something that's pretty important to us in terms of our revenue sources.
Thanks, Steve, and commissioners, I appreciate the opportunity to chat. Like Steve mentioned, just we've seen a lot of changes in the market. One fundamental change was the decrease in natural gas prices. We saw fracking bring natural gas to the $3. The $3 mark, and we've also seen the growth of renewables. So this discussion really is to talk about what kind of renewable additions we've seen, some pricing trends that we've seen. There was an RFP that did get a lot of press, too. It was for Xcel Energy in Colorado. We'll talk a little bit about that. And then talk a little bit about a Lazard study that gives some cost estimates. And then just talk a little bit about renewable and storage. So over the last 2 years, we've seen about 15,000 megawatts of wind capacity come on in the U.S., and then on the solar side, about 14,000. So really substantial amounts of generation coming onto the market. And what that's done is put downward price pressure in the West, particularly, too, because California has a really strong renewable portfolio standard. And since there's zero marginal cost, those additions come on and put downward pressure. And right now, there's not good price differentiation between the steel in the ground that we have that's more reliable and then the intermittent renewable. But it's definitely had an impact on the market. With the new administration, there's a level of uncertainty on what will happen as far as policy. And there is the phasing out of the ITC, the investment tax credit for renewables, and the PTC, the production tax credit for wind, and also just what kind of policies will be put forward. But there's some other trends that have made the long-term pricing come down even with those factors. Renewable energy, it's really well entrenched. You know, there was a talk probably 10 years ago, could you get to 20 or 30% renewables in California? And they've surpassed those amounts. And now we're to the spot where they're talking about, you know, 50% RPS. And, you know, those seem like viable options that will happen. As far as where wind and solar is now, and we'll talk a little bit about the pricing, they're cost competitive with what we consider traditional generation, coal, natural gas, fire generation, and hydro.
But that's only with the tax credits.
It is, but even when those tax credits go away, right now, I'm stealing some of the thunder here, but you know, there's wind deals that are getting done in the $16, $17 range per megawatt hour. And I was at a conference earlier this month, and they talked about with the PTC going away, you know, in 2024, they expect prices to be around $26. So the turbines are getting bigger, turbine blades are getting bigger. So there's some technological improvements that have been made. And also, too, just there's a lot of money in the market chasing right now. So, you know, you think about regulated rate of return for an IOU, and then, you know, they're 10% say plus or minus. You know, there's offshore funds that are willing to get a 4 or 5% return. So you see really cheap capital coming in, and you see some improvements in the market. So even without the incentives, we're seeing the potential for low price deals. I think on the solar side, and it's speculation probably to a certain extent, but the rate of decline on solar, once the ITC is gone, they thought maybe 3 years to get back to where the pricing is. So the incentives are going away. They've definitely, you know, spurred the market on, but the prices are just a lot lower than folks thought they would be at this time. Yep. In the near term, you know, we're probably going to see a decrease in the next 2 years, 3 years. The pace of growth will come off a little bit just because those incentives are going away. There's some uncertainty in the market. But the other thing that we've seen, too, is there's a lot of commercial and industrial customers that are directly engaging the wind and solar developers. So in the last administration, they talked about the Clean Power Plan and a lot of policies that would come in to reduce carbon. And even with those policies going away, state policies and corporate policies are really causing more bill than folks would have anticipated. Longer term, just trends that have caused the power prices to come down. Customers have demanded it. You know, there's certain folks, even like Nike, I think their demand across the globe is small compared to, say, a server farm. But their customers want them to be clean, and a lot of it's, too, that they want additional assets that have been built. So we see demand on that side. There's been a decline in prices, like I mentioned, and then just people want a decarbonized market, especially you know, folks that are in their 20s and 30s. It's part of the culture that they want. It's things that generation has asked for. And then I think there's the last one that's mentioned too is a drive for resiliency. So a trend towards smaller projects that are widely dispersed versus large heavy infrastructure in one place. Just some of the drivers, like I mentioned, that have caused prices to come down, technological improvements, federal incentives. It's much more competitive as far as procurement. There's a lot of folks in the market, and money, I think, is cheaper than folks have anticipated. And then I think also just there's a lot more folks that are experienced in the development side. So we're seeing projects that are cheaper, quicker to come online. Just as far as how fast prices have decreased. Solar PV has fallen 70% between 2010 and 2017. And then just the levelized cost of energy is 73%. So you see prices coming down substantially. Offshore wind is down 20%. And then we're seeing onshore winds down about 15% from 2017 to 2022, the projection. So still some decline there. These are power purchase prices. So again, some of those would have the subsidies in, but if you look at where we were on solar, PPAs were getting done in the $160 range in 2013, and then down in 2017, and we're in the 60s, 2020, down in
the PPA?
Power purchase agreement, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, all so right. It's the contract for purchase, so the levelized cost. And then onshore wind, same, you know, contracts in 2012 in the 80s, and then down in the 40s, and it's probably even lower than that. And just another pictorial of how fast those prices have declined, and then also a projection of where costs are headed. So the one that, again, caught a lot of folks' eyes, Xcel Public Service of Colorado issued an RFP late in 2017. They had bids at the end of November. They received more than 400 proposals, and they had record low prices for renewable and then also renewable that was paired with energy storage. So this is the median price for wind plus storage was $21 per megawatt hour, and solar was $36 per megawatt hour. And those are the medians. So that means that the actual contracts could be, you know, below those prices. And that's paired with storage. And it's hard with the information that was available to know how much storage was paired and then how much the storage window is too. If it's 4 hours of storage or 8 hours of storage, that's not transparent at this time. But those are really, really low prices. And Lazard, which is a investment firm, annually puts out their projections. So their projection for solar plus storage was 82, and you see the Xcel Energy price come in at 36. It was an eye opener for a lot of folks. So there's been other deals that have been done, but this really was something that caught folks' eye as far as what prices are and what developers are willing to contract.
Mike, what is the most common storage that's being utilized here?
I think it's lithium ion.
Okay. Batteries.
Yeah, batteries.
Okay.
Yep. And like in California too, like pumped hydro, they wouldn't even count as storage. You know, they're trying to develop a business too, but it's lithium ion that's mostly cited.
All right.
So it just, you know, as far as punchline, you know, even with the wind down of subsidies, renewable prices are cost competitive.
Excuse me. Thank
you. Oh, that's fine. We have the same haircut. It happened.
Oh, yeah. Dang, seeing one Bradshaw.
Exactly, yeah.
My apologies.
No, that's fine.
Yeah.
But renewable prices, they're cost competitive even without the subsidies, which was a great question early on, and it's put downward pressure on the market. There's some other examples that I have listed here. I don't know if I need to go through them, but it's really, you know, it's a great industry. It's an interesting time all the time in the industry, but these are trends that we wanted to make sure that we discussed at this level because strategically it does have an impact on the decisions that we make.
So just a comment, having spent a little time in Tucson recently looking at the Tucson Electric Power, they probably can reduce their cost of electricity by charging the cars that park under the solar panels for the shade they get in the summertime. So there's a second train of income. I mean, really, it's amazing. Entire parking lots, it is now covered parking with solar panels.
Yeah, it's amazing. And again, just the costs, and also you get the double benefit. But it's it's no longer just something that's going to be in fits and spurts. You know, we're going to see more build come into, I think. Any other questions at all? I appreciate you taking the time to listen.
But yeah, it's a great report. I mean, my mindset was from previous information, you know, not from our staff, but attending, you know, other conferences, that kind of thing is certainly antiquated. This is a really nice update.
Yeah, they're eye-opening prices.
Thank you. Very sobering.
They are. Mm-hmm. Pardon me?
Very sobering.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you.
Thanks.
And we'll work on the name.
No, that's fine. Thanks. I've been called worse.
Right. So are we at manager items?
Yeah, I'm going to take the first one because I think it follows on to the discussion we just had. So I want to give you a quick update on things that are happening in California. Every region of the country has a reliability coordinator. We have one in the West. It's called PEAK. They have been operating for quite a while. As the markets are moving, there's a group of utilities in the Mountain West that have proposed leaving and moving to the Southwest Power Pool for market purposes. And when they go there, they're planning to also take their reliability coordination services as well. That started to create consternation in the West because basically the cost structure for PEAK would remain the same, but smaller denominator in terms of who's paying for it, so higher cost for everybody else. Signals were being sent to PEAK that they needed to do something to manage their costs. They responded probably about 4 or 5 months ago with a proposal that they would combine with PJM, which is Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Maryland. They are an RTO in the East, and they would put together markets for the West, and that PEAK felt that they could reduce their costs if they could spread the costs across a bigger base, so they were going to put that proposal together. I would say in general that has not been well received in the West. People have lots of views on markets, and lots of efforts have been made to try and put in place markets in the West, and just wasn't a feeling that on the accelerated time frame that PEAK was talking about, that was a viable option, and didn't feel like it was the right response to address the cost per unit problem. In response to that, the California Independent System Operator proposed that they would provide RC services, reliability coordination services, to the West. And that set off quite a flurry of activity as to, so are people going to rely on PEAK, or are they going to go to the CAISO to receive their RC services? All of that came together March 1st. There were some deadlines around declaring where you were for each balancing authority. Chelan had to declare where it is. PEAK, in response to a meeting that was held at the public generating pool, provided an option where you could say you were going to drop out of PEAK, but it's a revocable waiver, and the contract had left that unclear as to whether, if you said you were going to drop out, whether you were required to drop out. So they've created an option that basically created optionality for all of us. You can say you're getting out under the terms of the contract, but you can reverse yourself and come back in. So it just gives more time to make a decision. Same time, CAISO was putting together their proposal and required a letter of interest to join the CAISO RC services if you wanted to be inside the tent. If you weren't willing to provide that letter, then you didn't get to be inside the tent, be part of the conversation. So we have sent both. We've sent a letter to PEAK saying we are exercising our right to leave within 18 months pursuant to the terms of the contract, but we have a countersignature from PEAK saying that it's a revocable waiver, in other words, that we can change our minds in that time frame. And we sent a letter to the CAISO saying we want to be inside the tent and want to be part of that discussion. But we added another sentence to our letter that said we are very much concerned with the CAISO taking over more functions, and they also are expanding the size of their market currently. As to the fact that what has been a concern for us for years, that nothing has been done on the governance side of the issue, that CAISO is still, the board is still selected by the governor with the concurrence of the state legislature. And that, to us, suggests that that's not independence and therefore not the kind of market operator that you could count on would provide an operation that was fair to all parties across the West. So all to say, there's a lot in motion right now, and we're part of that, as is every other balancing authority in the West, and trying to figure out where we want to be. I raise this in part because it's important, but also because it's another one of those drains on our resources right now. So you just got a presentation this morning with respect to transmission and how we're trying to figure out a very complex question about how we price transmission for things like cryptocurrency loads. So similar group, same group that's working on the issues associated with how do we receive reliability coordination services, generally a transmission function as RC services. That was a lot in a short period of time. Any questions about that?
Steve, I have a good question. Is there any possibility that the governing structure and the way that it is appointed through the governor of California would be modified?
There is legislation before the California legislature that would do that. It has been before the legislature the last two legislative sessions and not been successful. There is a contingent of environmental and labor interest groups that have opposed giving up control of the California system that has been successful so far in thwarting any legislation moving forward. There's another group in the environmental community that is supportive of moving forward. The governor has been supportive of making a change, recognizing that California needs integration services as it expands its use of renewables. So we're watching and trying to figure out if there's any way to play a role there that would help to move forward. But it's really California constituencies that are going to decide the outcome of that, which is, of course, our frustration with how the CAISO is governed.
Thank you.
Okay. Let me see. In the room, Ron, you are here. Excellent. So Ron Slabaugh is going to give us an update on the Upper Valley Regionalization Study. Remember, this is a public power benefit program.
Hey, Steve. Good afternoon, everyone. I spoke with the board and asked about this project about a year ago. I believe it was the March 6th board meeting. We provided the fact sheet that we had put together and just the summary of our expected path forward. We've executed on the majority of that. City of Leavenworth agreed to lead this effort, and that included the selection process for a utility financial consultant to carry out the regionalization feasibility study. We also assembled a stakeholder group. It was made up of community members and elected officials from all of the entities or agencies included. Of course, that's us, City of Leavenworth, City of Cashmere, Peshawson Water District, and Chelan County. Commissioner McKenna has been attending, representing Chelan PUD. We had a kickoff meeting. We've had three progress meetings. The consultant has met with each of the entities individually to collect specific information from them to help in their efforts of putting the study together. We are scheduled to receive the draft study from the consultant by the end of this month, and we're currently in the process looking at trying to get everybody's schedules together to schedule an update meeting with the consultant. This would be an after-hours public meeting with everybody, say the last 2 weeks in April. The consultant will present the findings, and we'll have an opportunity for questions and answers from the public.
So we'll keep you informed as to the scheduling of that meeting.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
Hey, Ron. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Oh, how about that? Oh. Huh? Nice. Good to have one.
It is.
Next one, I ask Michelle Smith and Ryan Baker to come up and talk about the closure of Chelan Falls Powerhouse Park.
Hi, Michelle. Good afternoon, commissioners. On the lighter side, probably, of other things you've talked about today, we wanted to let you know that we are going to be seeing a closure of Powerhouse Park beginning July 30th, which is a Monday, basically through the end of the summer season for that park due to some erosion control work. That work has been basically in the works for almost a decade. We've been pushing it off and pushing it off. The area, as you can imagine, I'll point it out here. A lot of impact from the Chelan River coming down, and so whenever we have higher flows, especially anything above 5,000 CFS, it really hits that shoreline pretty hard. So we've been watching the erosion kind of progress over the years, and now it's to a point where we feel we have to do something. The swim beach is right there. There's a little boat launch, and then also that shoreline is used pretty extensively by fishermen. So it's also starting to undermine some of the irrigation system and the restroom facilities there. So we thought it was time. We've been in a couple years of permitting. We're expecting to get the final Corps of Engineers permit by the end of this month, maybe even into the next next month. But we expect that we will get that soon, and we can start the work on July 30th.
That's low water.
Yes.
Okay.
Low water, and we have quite a communications outreach plan. Suzanne and her team have been helping us with that. We have posters and flyers and advertising, and Suzanne. Oh, and a direct mail piece. Thank you, Suzanne.
Good. Yeah, I anticipate some angst, public angst, because it's like we've waited all season for this, and now you close it, but it's the appropriate time to do the work.
Yes, I should add that the reason that that time frame was selected was due to the permit requirements for in-water work. So because of the salmon and steelhead issues in that area, we have only a window that we're allowed to do in-water work. So that's usually August, September, October, and that's the case for our permits there. So it's not like we can pick the middle of winter to do that kind of work.
And this has gone out to bid?
Yes.
Okay.
And if you need to know anything more, I did bring Ryan with me, so he's familiar with that information. If you'd like to know more, we can offer that too.
Question. Other thoughts and comments? Questions? Okay, hearing none.
Thank
you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I should think of some question. Get Ryan.
That's right.
I want to invite Tracy out and Sean Seaman to come up and give the final legislative update for the year.
Good afternoon.
Tracy Hunt, Director of External Affairs.
And Sean Seaman with External Affairs.
So we had an exciting 60-day session, and I'm going to spend a few minutes kind of summarizing some carbon-specific issues, and then Sean has some highlights that he's going to go over with some other issues that we saw. So there were some bills that didn't pass that we will likely see again. One of them is establishing higher carbon reduction targets. We expect to see the same bill or something similar next year, moving the targets to 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. They're identifying that as being more consistent with emerging science and literature as the right targets. Another piece of legislation, you may have heard it referred to as the A4, which stands for Alternative Form of Regulation. It's essentially a $40 planning adder to carbon-based resources that IOUs would incorporate into their planning. So they basically put that $40 adder and then compare that to other resources, making renewables and wind, solar, more attractive compared to carbon-based resources.
So that's $40 a ton on carbon.
Yeah, $40. Well, it's $40 per megawatt.
It's not, so right. It's not so if they got carbon.
Right. So if they got a bid of $30 for, let's say, gas, and then there was a bid for $50 for solar, you would take and add $40 to the gas, so you'd be at $70, and then you compare that, or they would compare that to the $50 for the gas.
So the method of generation, gas or coal, wouldn't matter?
I don't know if it would depend on the carbon intensity between.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Another part that of that bill that was interesting, it also creates an opportunity for IOUs to get a rate of return on power contracts from renewable resources such as hydropower. We also expect to see a 100% clean energy bill, which essentially would eliminate from electricity rates all costs from coal, and require studies, and there'd be tax exemptions, or we saw tax exemptions for eligible renewable investments and tax credits for clean energy investments. So we expect to see that. Another is the Energy Coalition Renewable Portfolio Standard, which in the last form we saw a 50% renewable portfolio standard for IOUs and a 15%, which is a continuation of the current RPS for consumer-owned utilities for us. So it would basically be the same for COUs, and it would ramp up to 50% for IOUs. We've already seen a second version of the carbon tax initiative. That's a $15 a ton, increasing $2 a year. So this will be a voters' initiative that we will be seeing if they get the vote or if they get the signatures. There are some exemptions. Utilities would retain the taxes as long as they had a plan for how those monies would be spent and that was approved by Commerce. They also creates a 15-member oversight board for implementation of the program as well as the funding where the tax revenues would go. One aspect of the initiative in this second version we saw, there was a point of regulation that was really important to how we view markets being impacted by a carbon tax, and they did change the point of regulation to something that we thought was better for how markets would actually need to operate. So that was a good thing that happened right before they submitted the initiative a few weeks or just 2 weeks ago.
Tracy, was there? I'm sorry. Go ahead. I've got mine written down, so maybe I won't forget it.
All right. That governing board you're referring to. How would that governing board be selected?
So it's a 15-member board, the public oversight board, established within the executive office of the governor, and they'll have 15 voting members. Position appointed by the governor, and then four at-large positions appointed by the governor, must have one tribal, one vulnerable population representative, six co-chairs of the panels, one commissioner, the commissioner of public lands, and then three directors consisting of the Department of Commerce, Department of Ecology, and Recreation and Conservation. And then the non-voting members would be Department of Health, Transportation, the Superintendent of Public Instruction.
Didn't hear any PUDs in there.
Didn't hear any mention of the public, really.
Just checking.
There are also investment panels, appoint member 4-year staggered terms for investment panels. What I can do is get you a summary of how they've contemplated this moving ahead so you have a sense. There's going to be subsequent discussions we're going to need to have about the status of the initiative and what we're hearing. So I'm sure we'll need to continue this discussion, and so we can put together some information on that so you have that readily available.
Yeah. Our concern is, you know, has always been not having a seat at the table.
And this is one of the challenges of some of how this works was similar to the governor's carbon tax proposal.
Right.
So there's some similarities, but obviously there's some differences. And one of the main differences is this was put together with a group of people that sat and compiled their thoughts compared to the open process that was being discussed as part of the last legislative session. So we just knew more about that than we do this. There's also a lot in this that's left to rulemaking. Which is clearly a risk. There's less specificity than we might like to see at this point. So there's a lot of work that will be happening around this initiative.
Later. Thank you.
Yes. Of note, however, is that even if the carbon tax initiative passes, it is still very likely that we will see the 100% clean energy bill move ahead because the proponents view the tax and the 100% as complementary policies. So with or without the carbon tax initiative, we will still have a busy, long session next year. And we will put together some information that describes how they work. Essentially, the 100% clean gives targets. And, you know, if a carbon tax, if a utility wants to use a resource that has carbon content, they pay the tax. And if you have 100% clean, there's increasing levels. And if you don't meet the targets, you have a penalty. And the penalty is about three times that of the tax. So if you use carbon and you're not following the trajectory of reductions, and you exceed that, you pay a penalty, plus then you pay the tax on that. And one could argue, well, what do you do when you need gas for reliability? Then you have, essentially at that point, you would have the penalty and the tax to make sure that you contain or follow or meet your reliability standards.
So that's covered in rates then?
That would have to be covered by each utility, right? So there's some more assessments that needs to be that we'll need to pursue on that, but we do expect many of these things to be recycled next year. We think there's a lot of work that has to be done with the initiative following that, and we will be in contact and engage when we get our assessments. Any questions we also expect Sean would have a better sense even. There's going to be other energy-related legislation, DER and other things we'll surely see. So this isn't the full suite of energy-related legislation that we'll see next year.
DER.
Distributed Energy Resource Planning. So I'll jump, segue
yep.
for me is... The report I'll give here just briefly is about the bills that passed, but since Tracy mentioned there's a suite of bills that did not pass related to distributed energy, net metering, billing issues, that none of them made it through the process. So although we start all over again next year, we'll start a new session, we anticipate they will all be back in some form or fashion, including pole attachment issues, and net metering and other distributed energy planning bills. So we'll be getting ready for that again over the interim, as we do each year, planning, knowing what we're likely to see. We'll be working with staff and others outside the utility to be including other agencies and utilities. Be ready for next year, knowing what we're likely going to see. So to jump into what bills did pass that we are watching, again, we've been using LobbyGov as a way to track. It's a service that we are able to use, and then we put bills in as I get them that I think have an issue related to us. We had 225 bills that we were just watching. That doesn't mean they had anything directly to do with us. Maybe they were tangentially impacting us, so we just track those. Of those 225, we have 36 bills that actually have either been signed into law by the governor or they've been delivered to the governor. Of those 36, there's only a handful of those that have a direct impact to us. I'm just going to highlight some of those that we've been talking about these all along. But these are the bills that I think are of note. The road worker safety bill has actually now been signed by the governor. And what this basically does, will add utility trucks, or in this case our fleet of vehicles now, add to the law that governs roadway use. So vehicles traveling on the road have to pull over, or if they can, for emergency response vehicles, tow trucks. Now they're going to add another suite of vehicles to that same regulation. Mm-hmm. So if our trucks are on the side of the road, the vehicles traveling on the road will follow the same laws they follow for law enforcement, other emergency response.
It means like on a four-lane highway, you need to move change
correct.
Lanes.
Okay. Correct, or slow down if you can. The same laws, but now they've just amended those laws and added our vehicles into that. You need to have lighting requirements, but for all these that I'm going to talk about, Melinda Barnes now is taking a look at these and seeing, are we in compliance? What do we have to do to get into compliance? So she's looking through all this list as well, and she'll look at a broader list to make sure there wasn't something else that we didn't have. Roadway worker safety signed into law. There's been a couple human resource related bills. One was called related to job applicants and arrest records. can no longer ask at this point as part of an application anything about a criminal history. You can once you've identified they're qualified for a job, then you can ask for that information. But beforehand, you need to just wait. Once they're qualified, then you can ask for that information. The Workplace Gender Pay Equality Bill also has been delivered and expected. It'll be signed. It's going to just add a definition to similarly employed. The words are in there, but now they're defining what that means. And also, though, this law will provide for remedies and actions. It'll address career advancement opportunities for gender and will prohibit requirement of non-disclosure of wages. So, again, these are issues that HR will be looking at and making sure we're in compliance with, and Melinda will be helping. Another bill was related to everyone touched on that one. I apologize. The prevailing wage bill, we talked about that. The Department of Labor and Industries will now use collective bargaining agreements to develop prevailing wages. If in our area there is a CBA, collective bargaining agreement, for that particular trade or craft. Otherwise, they'll have to refer back to old methods. But it gives them a newer tool, which they think is going to make it easier for them to calculate prevailing wage. The Voting Rights Act has passed. We're still analyzing that, and we'll have some other conversations about that later when we fully understand that particular bill. The PUD Retail Telecom Bill, this was the Kitsap-only bill referred to, as I think you're very well aware of what happened with that based on WAPUTA meetings, the PUD Association meetings. The Bargaining Unit Rep Access Bill passed, which was this bill requires us to provide access to new union employees, access from the bargaining representation to those new employees within 90 days, 30 minutes of access basically on the clock within the first 90 days of employment. Now that is into state law. There was the last bill of note that I think was talked about at the recent meeting last week with the PUD Association meeting. Had to do with port districts having telecom authority. And what they basically, the law and before, limited to rural port districts, and now eliminate the term rural and the definition of rural to allow other port districts to have access or allow to provide wholesale telecommunication services. So in reality, that was the ones I highlighted that we've been tracking closely with you. I'm sorry, one last one. I had to turn my paper over. It had to do with changes to PERS 1, basically a cost of living adjustment. Now, when we first started looking at the bill, they were suggesting a 3% cost of living adjustment one time for PERS 1 and the teacher's retirement system. At the end of the day, it's down to 1.5%, but it's also limited to $62.50 per month. So that has some impact to us as an employer, but it will provide a 1.5% increase for the PERS 1 one time. And that's the highlights that I have.
Randy?
Just a comment. When we were at PUD Association last week, we had a legislative recap similar but not totally like yours. And one of the things that George Kahn, the executive director, did a shout out to Chelan PUD and most especially our human resources people, Lorna, and their assistance in providing guidance on so many of those issues that you've talked about. Don't fall under energy or it's general government. And right. So I don't know if you were there when George provided the shout out saying that Chelan was of great assistance to the association this past year. So,
well, that's good to hear. Hopefully Lorna has heard that. And so there's three of us here at the PD that do reviews for WAPUTA. I review environmental bills. Mike Coleman reviews telecommunications bills. And Lorna does the HR bills, and WAPUTA taps into others throughout the membership to help review bills. And the last thing I'll say is, unfortunately, we weren't able to have Dave Arbaugh here who does an incredible amount of work, an incredible job for not only us, but his assistance with WAPUTA is important as well. And the Utility Coalition worked very well together this year, and I think it was helpful in our efforts in helping with those, particularly the energy-related bills.
Yeah, and along those lines, just of note, there was a real transition where public generating pool did become a voice recognized by the legislature when it comes to energy bills or energy legislation, especially around the carbon issue, being a technically credible source for information, speaking to several legislators, speaking to the governor. So they have created themselves, we being part of it, as a resource, and we expect that to continue next year.
Very good. Thank you.
Yep. Right, thank you.
Appreciate it.
I just have one more manager item, and that's that this Friday there's the Mariachi Festival, and so we will be giving out two scholarships to the STEM Academy. Recall that the STEM Academy is the program that we run out at Rocky Reach in the summer, focused on pathway to college. One young man, one young woman, hopefully will receive that award, and will also be visible there at the festival.
Yeah. And Mario, our gifted employee who is in the middle of everything now and does it very well, you know, shared that with me at an event Friday night, and you'll have the opportunity to present the, you know, scholarships, and I think that's perfectly placed. But I just, you know, wanted to say that the more I watch him work in the community, the more appreciation I have. He is literally integral to almost everything, and everybody gives him a call, and people are happy when they see him. So he's just weaving a lot of really good things together, and I appreciate him very much.
Thanks.
Yeah, and thanks for agreeing to be there. He also convinced Joyce Lynn and I to buy tickets and be there Friday night, so we will be there as well. So God bless him. Any other thoughts or comments?
You know, I did want to mention one other thing, and that's just that we were prepared to give you an update on electric vehicles today. That's actually in the district performance plan, that we get that done in the first quarter. We pulled it because of all the other things that we have going on right now. So count that as another one that we will be challenged on in terms of meeting the plan for this year.
Okay. Commissioner items. Any? All right. Item 15, follow-up on delegation of action items from previous board meetings.
So we've got a few. Still the ball's on my court to follow up with Commissioner Arsenault on his request to visit the Skaha Hatchery. Get back to him on that. You should have received an email from Mike regarding outreach to the county regarding road work on Eagle Creek Road.
Steve,
can we go back to the hatchery in Canada? I would just like to be informed on that too.
Okay.
Maybe that's a RV road trip up to camping or something. But
I don't know if we should let both of you cross the border.
Get back in.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Jeopardize our quarry or our quorum.
Like, yeah, no, I think that's great.
There was a question for Eric about determining the effective date for the Voting Rights Act, and he sent out an email on that. Have you seen that? And I'm just going to take this one and say we're going to get back to it later. This is the one on how HDL loads will impact our resource portfolio. Really, the fundamental question is what type of service do the HDL loads want? And yeah, it makes a pretty big difference in terms of how it affects our resource portfolio. So we're just going to take some more time to figure that out and then be able to put that back together in a package once we understand it. We also had one left over from two meetings ago to describe the advantages and disadvantages of a moratorium approach. I think you saw our today. And we have a few others that we are still working on, and we'll be getting back to you. That's it.
Okay. Item 16, delegation of action items.
Tracy has one to provide a summary of the carbon tax initiative. Get back to you with some more specifics about what's going to be in the ballot initiative. We're going to get back to you with some more information about the HDL criminal issues, how these would be prosecuted, and whether there would be civil remedy. I have to admit, I'm not recognizing this last one, so Eric, you may have to help me with this.
There was just a question that came up during the HDL presentation on whether that would be required.
I'll talk with you offline on that, Commissioner. I'm not sure I entirely understand what your question was, but okay. I'm happy to circle up.
Help me understand what that is.
This is on the question about the HDL rate structure, and is it proprietary or public?
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks. Okay.
And that's all we have. Miss anything?
Don't think so. Additional public comment, and we have staff only. So matters of general business. Hearing none, we're heading toward executive session. And what is the likelihood of the time frame needed?
90 minutes.
90 minutes. Perfect. Okay. Regarding executive session, we will take a five-minute break and then go into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risk as authorized by RCW 42.30.1101I, to consider the selection of a site or acquisition of real estate by lease or purchase when the public knowledge regarding such acquisition. Where'd I go?
Consideration.
Consideration. Thank you. Got it. Would cause a likelihood of increased price as authorized by RCW 42.30.1101B, and to consider the minimum price at which real estate will be offered for sale or lease when public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause the likelihood of decreased price as authorized by RCW 42.30.1101C for approximately 90 minutes, starting at...
I apologize. Could we add one to that?
Yes.
Could we add, and you'll need to say it, the review of a performance of a public employee as authorized by the statutes?
So said.
Thank you.
Yeah. For 90 minutes, starting at... Oh. Okay. So we'll cover this in just a second.
Yeah, we can do that in April.
We can do this in April.
The April 2nd meeting.
Okay. For 90 minutes starting at 2:10. This is Chelan County Board of Commissioners coming back into session out of executive session where no decisions were made, no votes were taken. Our time is 3:22 p.m. I think there's one other item on our agenda this afternoon. And I'll turn to Commissioner Smith.
Yes, Mr. President, I'd like to move to set a series of meetings. I would like to move to set a special meeting April 13th, 2018 at the Port of Quincy, 101 F Street Southwest in Quincy, for the purpose of holding a joint meeting with Grant County PUD to receive customer service training. And I would like to move to reschedule our June 18 and July regular board meetings as follows. Reschedule the Monday, June 18, 2018 regular board meeting to Monday, June 25, 2018 to begin at 10 a.m. in the headquarters boardroom. Reschedule the Monday, July 2, 2018 regular board meeting to Monday, July 9, 2018 to begin at 10 a.m. in the headquarters boardroom. And to reschedule the Monday, July 16, 2018 regular board meeting to Monday, July 23, 2018 to begin at 10 a.m. at headquarters boardroom.
Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to alter our schedule as presented by Commissioner Smith. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Any other items to come before the commission? Hearing none, we're adjourned.